Tonight on The Download, hip-hop artist and now basketball mogul Ice Cube, Chicago crime fiction writer Marcus Sagi, and another installment of The Swap Meet with Greg Lamb. Now, here's your host, a man who also messed around and got a triple-double, Justin Kaufman.
Oh, can you imagine me and Cube on the court, messing around, getting a triple-double. I gotta say, it was a good day. Wow. There's so many great lyrics in that song. I listened to that song all day today. It was a good day. Mama cooking breakfast with no hog. Really good stuff. No helicopters looking for the murders. I think the best line overall for Cube's "It Was a Good Day" is when he says, she had the boom, I had the chronic. The Lakers beat the Supersonics. Oh, it's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Tonight, Ice Cube in studio. An interview with him about, of course, the new 3-on-3 professional basketball league that's coming to the UIC Pavilion this Sunday, featuring greats like Allen Iverson, Charles Oakley, Dr. J. It's kind of a great idea, 3-on-3 sport in which former NBA stars who have to be 30 years old and up play each other in a 10-week league. There's a bunch of teams, but they go week by week to different cities. So they play one quadruple tournament, like a quadruple header at the UIC Pavilion starting at 2 o'clock on Sunday. And you go out one ticket and you get to watch all the games, and they move on to the next city, and the championship will be in Las Vegas in a month or so. But the creator of this league is Ice Cube. Ice Cube, famed, of course, from NWA, from movies like Boys in the Hood, Friday, Ride Along, 21 Jump Street. He's been in a lot of stuff, and he continues to make music and movies. He's celebrating the 25th anniversary of his album Death Certificate. And like I was just saying to Roe and Anna, if you watch the show The Defiant Ones on HBO, it's a four-part documentary about Jimmy Iovine. Is it Iovine or Ovine?
Iovine,
got it. Have you watched it, Domati?
I haven't seen it
yet.
It's
so good.
I really want to see this.
It's really great. And it's about him, and it's about Dr. Dre and how they came together on the album with The Chronic and Interscope Records. And it's great because there's so many stars who actually are on camera talking about their story.
But I'm excited you're talking to Cube tonight because when you think about it, NWA really opened the door for all of these documentaries about hip hop.
Yeah, it's amazing how documented that story has become.
Man,
with Straight Outta Compton, of course, and then there was the book that we had that was not too long ago, and then this is a documentary that retells that story with more personal interviews with Dre and Cube and others. But, of course, and it even gets into the rivalry, and it gets into when Ice Cube left NWA. But, I mean, it's safe to say that Ice Cube is one of the best artists of a generation. And we'll talk with him about his new basketball league, but also about his career. Like I said, 25 years since the album Death Certificate came out. I'm so excited. I ironed my jeans today for Ice Cube. You know, when they come out of the dryer and you're like, why is this wrinkled on the bottom? I can't have bottom wrinkled jeans for Ice Cube. I'm going to get the iron out. I've not done that ever. This is the first time. I was like, I had a little trickle of sweat. I was like, what? This can't be happening. They're wrinkled on the bottom. Like from the knee down. It's kind of like got a wrinkled. And I just didn't have the time. So I'm like, I need to put an iron to this. I need to fix this. I can't have Ice Cube looking at my janky, wrinkled jeans. So that tells you how important it is tonight for Ice Cube. Also coming up in this great show tonight, Marcus Sagi is here at the big table. Marcus Sagi, longtime crime fiction writer, best-selling author, award winner. A lot of his books have been turned into movies. His new book is out. It's called Afterlife. And it also just announced, I think it was today, it was announced that Imagine Entertainment optioned it for a film. So we already got a film. We're going to talk about the brand new novel, and then we're going to talk about the fact that it's being optioned to Hollywood already. Marcus Sagi, Chicago crime fiction novelist, in studio tonight. Talk about his new book, Afterlife. We'll talk about showbiz. optioning films, all that kind of stuff. And also setting all of his novels in Chicago. So that's coming up tonight, Marcus Seiki. Of course, Mike Fouché is here. It's Wednesday night. We got a lot to talk about, specifically about school funding. This is a head-scratcher as we seem to move from conflict to conflict. Now that the budget conflict is over, the state, House, and governor seem to be setting up for a conflict over Illinois schools. Will we? I can't believe I'm even saying this, Pete. But will the doors open for school in August? Here we go again. And it's Wednesday night, of course. The swap meet on tonight at 10 o'clock. Greg Flamm at DuPage Picker to evaluate all your collectibles, memorabilia, and junk. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Doma Tipongo and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do the carry out. Stay with us. All right, it's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. All right, here are today's top stories. The Congressional Budget Office fast becoming a political enemy to the Republicans with their projections and calculators. The CBO predicts 32 million people would lose insurance based on the latest proposal just to repeal Obamacare and chill. This up from the repeal replace estimates, which were closer to 25 million. So what's it mean? It means that there are a lot of people in this country. That's about it. And also that this issue, once again, will be the main ballot issue come 2018. Oh, goody. I was hoping we could argue about federalized health care for a full year and a half till a midterm election. Right? Isn't that what you were hoping for? Christmas comes early. President Trump is in a bit of a hot water. A bit of a hot water. I like that. He's in a bit of a hot water for what's being called a second secret meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. It was at the big dinner at the G20, and Trump and Putin were spotted canoodling with translators in tow. What were they talking about? None ya business. Trump also went to Twitter to say it wasn't a meeting and, quote, hashtag fake news. I agree with Trump that it wasn't a meeting, but why not just tell us what was said? Are we really just arguing about what to call this encounter? Can we call it a tryst? How about a walkabout? Or how about a date? Can we call it a date? Whatever we call it, it's hopefully a non-story. For the record, way out of character and political etiquette to do it, but hopefully a non-story. I'm just saying, that's why the press is blowing up blurry pictures and putting a circle around it online. Is that Trump Putin talking, or is that a piece of lint on my screen? Journalism at its best. It took like 9 people to do that, too. Today, a teenage boy who was a victim of serial killer John Wayne Gacy was finally identified. He was a runaway from Minnesota. I'm glad that this will help the family with closure, but it also brings back one of the worst stories in modern Chicago history. Gacy, ugh, pass. Ugh. Another woman has come forward in the allegations against singer R. Kelly. She told Jezebel that the BuzzFeed story was accurate and that Kelly does have sexual relations with a number of women that he tries to control both sexually and psychologically, and that he makes the women call him daddy. Yeah, nothing to see here. I move along. These stories today, so bland, generic. And now there's a petition for his record label to drop him after yet another bombshell story in his sordid career. But something tells me as long as this Christmas record continues to sell, the company's going to be like, who, what now? Where? Huh? I think you got the wrong number. Click. I believe I can fly. Cha-ching. Here's a good government story for you. Some aldermen were pushing for a new ordinance that would force businesses to open their restrooms to non-customers. You know that thing that nobody was really complaining about? Well, aldermen seemed to be bored and wanted to conjure up the good old days of Burton Terrace because this is something akin to putting diapers on horses. Anyway, it stalled. So that's the story. It stalled. So society, you're just going to have to hold it a bit longer. In weather, easy, but rain's on the way for the next couple days. Severe weather reported in the area, warning until 12 tonight. In sports, all right, are we ready for the Moncada? Yoan Moncada is in the starting lineup tonight for the White Sox. I don't know if he is. Is he in the starting lineup? That's a good question. I'm not sure if he – actually, I'm looking at the state right now. There's one out, so I don't know when he's going to bat, what his deal is. But it doesn't really matter. What matters is the number one prospect in baseball is a prospect no more. How about it? This could be the biggest game down on the South Side since Chris Sale cut up some jerseys or when Konerko shaved his goatee. Oh, look, he shaved his goatee. Go Sox. This, of course, overshadowed the big trade. Todd Frazier, he gone, traded to the Yankees with most of the Sox bullpen for 2016 first-rounder Blake Rutherford. He's going to have to change that name or embrace it where he can wear peach-colored sweaters and play horse polo. But he's a big-time left-handed bat who plays in the outfield, so good to go. Speaking of polo, the Sox scored a guy named Tito Polo in the deal. Yep. Hopefully he could play. Not only will the Sox have the best team, but they'll bring back the art of the great baseball name. Tito Polo, the 2020 version of Tito Landrum. We'll take it. But Rutherford, Polo, and the existing Sox farm system should be fun. Until they're not, right? But right now, who knew losing could be so exciting? All right. On the other side of town, let's talk about the now. The Cubs are doing exactly what the fans expected, turning it on in the second half today. They poured it on, completed a three-game sweep of the Braves in Atlanta. They now picked up 3.5 games on the Brewers in a week. They are now two back and just getting hotter. Javi Baez, he's hit home runs in back-to-back games. And Kyle Hendricks, he is back on the mound this weekend. The Cubs are off tomorrow, which nobody wants. They need, don't mess with this mojo. We're hot. Stay hot. Can't we do a rain makeup or something? Isn't there a game that was rained out with the Brewers that we could play tomorrow? The Cubs come home to Wrigley on Friday for a series with the Cardinals, who are also hanging around, so it should be good. Baseball, right now, baseball is good. Baseball is good. Still steaming mad about the news that Jay Cutler is going to be in the broadcast booth for the Bears-Falcons game at Soldier Field to kick off the football season. I mean, don't get me started. It makes me so angry that Fox somehow believes that Bears fans want to hear what that clod thinks, right? If he even tells us what the QB was doing or what defense the Falcons were in, people are going to throw stuff at TVs. How do you know? Oh, what they're doing is a 3-4. You can see with the safety. No, no. You never saw that. You don't know what they're doing. A Jay Cutler broadcast should be, I hiked it. The quarterback hiked it. And then he just, you know, he threw it. Don't care. No way. I mean, I guess I get it. It's a good storyline, but there's no way that Bears fans would want to watch a broadcast that he's narrating. Give me a break. And fans have put their money where their mouth is when it comes to the Bulls. A billboard went up in the West Loop near the United Center that says, hashtag fire Gar Pax. We're no longer seeing red. Ooh. Always good when someone has extra cash to sink into billboards, right? We don't have enough trouble in a cash-strapped city that we live in. What we really need is a hashtag billboard. Can't say I disagree with the sentiment, but still. And finally, a boy in New Mexico was playing outside when he tripped over a million-year-old fossil. Yep, it turns out it wasn't just a clumsy misstep. Nope, it was bones from a dinosaur elephant, which just goes to show you when you trip over something, always look and see what it is. Don't just pretend like you were starting into a trot. Don't do that. That's the carryout for July 19th. That's what I do every time. Oh, I wanted to run. I'm just going to start running. Carry out for July 19, 2017. Hey, we have too many cups, not enough lids. So if you mind, we're just going to put a napkin over your Diet Coke. Look at it this way. You're saving the environment. All right, coming up, Mike Fouché is going to join us. We'll talk about schools and whether or not we should be worried. Schools are going to open in August. The download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Joe Matipongo, how are you, bud?
I'm good. How you doing, Josh?
Is this just a one shift tonight?
Just a one shift tonight.
Violetta and you're was slacking back. Now.
I know. Messing up my record there.
All right. So
life is easier when Violetta's back.
Yeah, that's true. Yes. That's true. So you're a big Ice Cube fan, huh?
I really am, man. I am. Ice Cube, I was thinking about this earlier when you talked about the beef that Rokan started talking about Chicago being the origin. Yeah, you remember Common beefed with Ice Cube back in the day.
We had a great author on who talked about the Louis Farrakhan meeting that happened in 1996 where he brought together the sort of warring factions of the East Coast and West Coast, including Common and Ice Cube. and they all went down to the Nation of Islam headquarters on the South Side, and they hashed it out.
Yeah.
That was the end of it.
And that was it.
That was it. It's amazing, like closed door, no media. Kind of, I mean, afterwards they had a press conference, but in the room they just like
Farrakhan said, "Chill out, 5 minutes, one and done, boom."
That's all you had to do, right?
Right here in Chicago,
right here. So the East Coast West Coast feud ended right here in Chicago.
It's a lot of history there.
There you go, bud.
It's a legendary interview you're gonna do.
Yeah,
tonight.
We'll see, man. We'll see.
I think we're breaking out of the groove.
Yeah,
here.
No,
this is kind of nice.
We're getting a little
nice
chill.
Music.
Yeah, a little chill, but serious chill.
Serious.
Mike Fouché is in the house. Of course, Mike joins us every Wednesday from the Daily Line to talk city politics, county politics,
state
politics. Just opened the Springfield Bureau. How's the Springfield stuff going?
It's pretty great, actually. Ray Hodge, our new editor, has really been killing it. She's been writing some great articles on SB1 and also on some of the budget stuff that's been going on. It's really exciting.
So the last time we talked, a budget was passed and we felt so good, and now there's harmony and chemistry, and everyone
peace,
is just this peace, love. It's like a Coca-Cola commercial from the 70s, 60s. Now it seems that the conflict has gone from the budget to school funding, the formula that is in this famed bill. I don't think there's any other bill that people know by name at this point, but SB1. What is SB1?
SB1 is incredibly ambitious. And the way that there is a formula that's used in order to fund all the schools across the state constitution says that the state is supposed to take on the majority of the cost of funding schools, primary and secondary education. But in reality, it's actually only funding like 26%. And there's a formula that's used in order to distribute the money across the state. The other big problem, though, is that the city of Chicago Public Schools, have never really been part of that formula. There's this big, nasty block grant that they vote on every year that changes every year. And it's really very political in terms of what it is. So SB1 is meant to change that and turn it into this formula that makes it so that schools that have the least amount of money, the smallest property tax base, which is really how most schools are funded, so that school districts that have the worst property tax base
get the most
money from the state, and that the schools that have the most poor children, the most special need kids, get the most money from the state.
Now, this was a controversial bill because it was introduced by Republicans, and over time, though, it's changed in the way that I don't know if it was Madigan or Culleton, whoever gets in the House, right?
I mean, there was a committee that was created, a special off the books committee of Democrats and Republicans, where they got together and met and talked about all the things that they wanted. And this formula has really come out of that. But the Democrats then broke out and created their own, which is SB1. And the big contentious part is that really what it does is that it puts an enormous sum of money to the city of Chicago.
Disproportionate to the formula.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It doesn't follow the formula.
It doesn't follow the formula.
And the argument that proponents of SB1 make is, look, the city of Chicago has a third of all of the poor kids in the state, so it needs to get the most money. The argument that people against SB1 have is, well, hey, look, the city of Chicago is the most property tax rich part of the state. It relatively has low property taxes when
so
you
they
compare
can get
it,
it from the
constituents, Peoria or
right,
Rockford.
Right.
They can afford to raise their property taxes and pay for all this. So this is really where we're at. And Governor Rauner has said, I'm going to veto SB1. And then what he has said recently is, no, I'm going to amendatory veto SB1, which means that in the state of Illinois, the governor, when they veto it, they can make specific changes to a bill. And then it goes back to the legislature
to how that's going to work. The forces in Governor Rauner, specifically his new staff, have people from the Illinois Policy Institute have come in, and it's been we talked about on the program, and others have had staunch, I guess, perspectives or stances when it comes to school funding, and have been really behind the rallying cry that Chicago, giving Chicago public schools any money is a bailout. This right. idea, this anti-Chicago narrative that has come up, it's always been there, but it continues to come up when it comes around school funding and the formula. This is really pitting the rest of the state against Chicago and the Chicago public schools.
Yeah, and part of the problem is that there's this whole concept that's in SB1, which is hold harmless, which is that everybody starts with the amount of money that they had in the previous year. And the hold harmless component is there because there are a lot of school districts that are losing students, that are losing their property tax base, and one of those places is Chicago. Chicago is losing students for the last 3 years at the rate of like 10,000 a year.
So the idea being, if they use a new formula, you would actually get less money than you got the year before based on students and
right,
population.
Right. So SB1 has this hold harmless. And one of the arguments that they're making about Chicago is, look, Chicago is in a lot of trouble. And so we need to be able to get the money to the city of Chicago so it can get itself out of trouble and be able to start working going forward. People from the rest of the state, other parts of the state say, no. You guys, you have plenty of property tax base. You should be able to take care of that on your own. So, you know, but then Chicago says, well, we send a disproportionate amount of money to the rest of the state. We should da da da.
Yeah, they've been having this argument for decades.
Forever.
So the idea, it started as an SB1 would be a veto from the governor, but then it became politically risky in the way that that would stop suburban and other state school districts from opening in August. I mean, they're only
right.
2 or 3 weeks away from opening in
well,
some areas.
Well, here's
the
deal.
State.
I mean, most school districts need to get their money by August 10th in order to be able to be ready for the school
year.
So less
than a month from now.
But really, it's not that they need to get their money on August 10th. They need to know the state, in order to make the gears turn right, really needs to know how much money everybody's going to get by August 1st. So really, August 1st is the day that we're concerned
about. 2 weeks, right.
And so
Less than 2 weeks.
The Senate, the SB1 passed the House and it passed the Senate. And now the president of the Senate, he can then what's called transmit the bill when he wants. And he hasn't transmitted it to the governor yet, which means he sends it along. And then once he transmits it, then the governor has an opportunity to veto it or not. Or sign it.
There's some politics, and it's a little bit, and Governor Rauner has pointed this out, this idea that the Democrats in the House and Senate like to play these games where it has been voted on and it hasn't been sent because they want to force a crisis. They want to force it get
correct.
To the last day possible.
Absolutely
so that
correct.
If Rauner does veto it, he looks like the bad
guy. This is a game of chicken. This is totally a game of chicken between the Senate President, John Cullerton, a Democrat, and a Republican governor. Bruce Rauner. This is totally a game of chicken. You know, Rauner has said that he's going to veto it. He said that he's going to mandatory veto it. Today, he released a website, which is actually pure political genius, if you ask me, which shows under his mandatory veto how much more money each individual school district across the state would get. So you can search, you know, Alton, Illinois, and boom, you get an extra, you know, $1 million or something like that, which is brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Right.
And but that's because there's $145 million that's taken away from Chicago.
Well, let me ask you the question probably on everyone's minds who's listening in the Chicago, who might have kids in the Chicago public schools. If an mandatory veto happens, what does that mean for Chicago public schools? I mean, do the House and Senate have the votes to override an mandatory veto? I don't think so. But I mean,
so there's two questions you got there. One is what happens to CPS, and the other is does the House have the votes in order to override the veto? Let's answer the first question. Mayor Emanuel has said again and again, schools will open on time. It seems that from what we've been looking at, that CPS will have enough cash on hand in order to open on time. The question is, how long will they be able to stay open? It also, though, CPS hasn't really revealed their full budget. They've talked about school budgets, but they haven't done their full budget. It definitely seems like CPS is going to be working with a major deficit this year. You know, anywhere between $750 million to, you know, $1 billion plus, which means that they're going to have to come up with the money in some other way. They're counting on the money that would come from SB1 in order to help reduce that. Even the money from SB1
doesn't come close to covering it.
So that means that they're still going to have to come up with money in some other way, which is likely either cut more cuts to CPS or some combination of cuts to CPS, and probably also, you know, taxes from the city of Chicago that would be diverted to CPS one way or another, I think. So to answer the other question, do they have the votes to override it in the House? They have the votes to override it in the Senate. I don't think they have the votes to override it in the House.
Also because you're not going to vote for it if you're not from Chicago.
Right.
Even if you're a Democrat, you're going to be like, well, I'm getting more money if I – I mean, you said, it's a little bit political genius in the way that
– I don't know if that's necessarily the case, but I think that they would definitely need a lot of Republicans to get on board with this, and I don't think they're going to get enough.
Mike Fouché, thedailyline.net, in studio as he is every Wednesday night. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and continue talking politics. Stay with us. Talking with Mike Fouché here on The Download, as we do every Wednesday night. Quick baseball update. Yoan Moncada had his first at-bat, and he walked.
Dun-dun.
So the Wilson Contreras's and the Javi Baez's, they hit home runs in their first at-bats. Moncada walks.
Yeah, hey, that's not a bad thing.
That's not bad.
That's kind of like setting the stage. You know, I'm threatening.
It was a smattering of applause for that walk. Mike Fouché, we're talking politics tonight. Two issues before we wrap up. One, okay, so the budget in Springfield has been passed, and we should all be rejoicing for them doing their job.
Yeah.
But there hasn't been much made about the $15 billion in backlog.
$15 billion with an $800 million interest payment. Isn't that awesome? That's pretty good.
There are a lot of people in Chicago that have complained and have protested about the idea of continuing to borrow, because here we are with an $800 million dollar investment payment to a bank of some sort that seems a little nefarious, but we'll go on from that. But you know, what has to happen here? I mean, is there a sort of concept in the budget that says, okay, we're going to...
It's not.
They just ignored it.
Let's just unpack this a little bit. I mean, the vast, vast majority of this are payments to providers and insurers for health insurance and for Medicaid payments. So there are – and also social service agencies. So basically, the people that are taking care of sick people, you know, people that in need, they are just really getting reamed here. I mean, even though the budget happened, and we were like,
social service agencies are finally going to get paid,
they're getting paid for the new stuff,
but they're not getting paid for the old.
Well, you know, they're getting paid for the old, but it's like a year behind. Like if you filed your bill, your invoice like a year and a half ago, you'll get paid.
Ugh.
Yeah.
So what's the plan?
The plan? There isn't one. I mean, that nobody's addressed it. I mean, that it hasn't been touched. And that's kind of what's amazing.
It is, because there is no such thing as municipal bankruptcy, so they're going to have to pay out at some point. I mean, is this the kind of thing where we're like in 10 years people are going to be getting paid from 2015?
Maybe. I mean, you know, why not, right? I mean, the Bank of England had like bonds from the 1740s that they're still paying. So, you know, why not Illinois? You know, I mean, I just read that there was a bond from the British East Indies Company that was just finally paid off. From like 1720.
So has there been any lip service to this from the governor, from the state house, from Madigan or Cullerton about we need to take care of this? This is irresponsible.
No, because the SB1 school funding thing has just occupied everybody's attention. Mm. I mean, that's the thing. As soon as we finish with this SB1 thing, we're going to have to go right to the bill backlog issue, which is a major issue for bonding agencies. You know, the bonding agencies are like, Illinois, you guys are really bad. You got to do something about this. And so, you know, I don't know. Maybe they'll deal with it.
Mike Fouché in studio tonight. Let's talk, the last thing we talk about, the Trib's done a lot of great work on the assessor's office, Assessor Joe Berrios, and the property tax. You got to explain it to me, because he was in front of, he was sort of defending himself very vehemently, if you will, this week. And I'm having a hard time understanding what's at stake with this argument that's happening over property tax evaluation.
So Cook County Assessor Joe Berrios and his team went before the Cook County Board yesterday, and there were a lot of questions. They were very nice to Assessor Berrios, but they really, really went after his team. And the thing that they have been asking about is and what the Tribune story from last month focused on, is that the way the formula works that they come up with the assessment throughout the city is that it's disproportionately focusing or disproportionately putting a heavier weight on people with lower valued homes. And part of the reason is that people with higher valued homes
appeal,
tend to appeal. And so as a result, there's more of a proportionate weight on people with lower valued homes. And the assessor says, oh, no, well, everybody can be able to appeal. You know, we do all kinds of training sessions in order to get people to appeal, which is true. You know, everybody knows you get these things from your alderman saying the assessor's coming through. Yeah. You can come learn how to appeal. But the truth is that people who are, you know, not as well off, maybe they don't have time, maybe they don't care, and they don't appeal. So the issue is that what the Tribune has pointed out and a lot of other analysts agree is that if you have a home that is worth less, you're probably paying proportionately more in property.
My last question quickly is, will there anything that comes out of the idea? I mean, are we going to change the appeal structure?
Well, I mean, that would be very complicated, not just the appeal structure, but also the formula for how they do assessments. It would be very complicated. Tony Preckwinkle, President Tony Preckwinkle, has said she's commissioning a study, so we'll see what happens.
All right. Mike Fouché from thedailyline.net joins us every Wednesday here on The Download. You can also get the podcast Aldercast, which is out on Fridays here on WGN+.
Yeah. Sign Mike, up for our Illinois edition, the Springfield
edition.
There you
go. Mike, thanks for being here, bud. Thanks, Domati. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 9 o'clock tonight, Ice Cube will be here. It's great to talk, I mean, to talk to him about not only his career, but his new venture. He's doing 3-on-3 basketball, this professional league. I actually saw a piece on it on SportsCenter not too long ago where Allen Iverson is really the star of the league. The idea is that these retired NBA players have joined this league created by Ice Cube, 3-on-3 tournament style, where they are on teams and they go from city to city, almost Harlem Globetrotter style, 10 weeks, and it culminates in a championship in Las Vegas. But it's amazing. It's a who's who. If you're an NBA fan, it's a who's who of players who have retired or now either coaching or playing on these teams. So it's a lot of fun to if you're in a 90s NBA, you'll love it. It's just, anyway, Ice Cube in studio talking about that league and, of course, his brilliant career. Coming up 9 o'clock hour. Well, tonight, my guest at the big table is a Chicago novelist who's written 9 books. Award-winning best-selling author Marcus Saeki just released his latest, Afterlife. Saeki, known for the Brilliance trilogy and for setting his crime fiction right here in Chicago, does it again. Afterlife takes place here and in an alternate Chicago, one caught between the living and the lost. This book explores what happens when the main character enters the afterlife and, well, how he gets back. Saeki's latest was optioned by Imagine Entertainment, so look for Afterlife to be on the big screen sometime in the near future. Optioning novels for film adaptation, it's nothing new for Saeki. Almost all of them have gone that route. Tonight, we talk crime fiction, the afterlife, showbiz, and of course, Chicago. My guest in studio at the big table, Marcus Saeki. Marcus, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're going to be at the bookseller on Friday for a signing. I should mention that as well.
Friday night at 7 o'clock. There I hope go. Some people can come out and join.
I'm sure they will. Afterlife, where's it come from? I mean, this is I mentioned in the lead, and people who know your work know that you set novels in Chicago. This is sort of set in Chicago. It technically is set in Chicago.
It is set in Chicago, where does
Afterlife come from?
You know, it's funny. That's a question that usually is very hard to answer. Usually authors kind of dodge when you ask that because we have no idea. This one I actually do know. It came from a dream. I had this dream some years ago where I was in Chicago. I was wandering around downtown, and I was alone. There was no one else there. And I knew with that kind of certainty that you have in dreams that it was because I was dead, that everyone else was there, that I was the one who was sort of pulled aside. But it wasn't a nightmare. It was just an interesting dream until I woke up. And I was laying in bed with my wife, you know, my partner of 20 years, and I imagined being in the same city, the same house, you know, the same room with her and not being able to talk to her, interact with her, hold her hand. And then it became a nightmare.
I mean, this really is made for to be a movie. I mean, when you read this book, you read thriller, you read crime, you read, I mean, even Chicago and terrorism. There's a lot that goes in. And, of course, the afterlife. For you to sort of write this book off a dream, but also be able to apply what you your trademark style of writing crime fiction for years now. I mean, what is it like to sort of discover the afterlife or to describe the afterlife in this scenario?
This book nearly sent me to the afterlife, Justin. This one was hard. I rewrote the first 100 pages 9 times, just trying to find the right way in and the right balance between the characters. It is about the afterlife, but it's a very grounded afterlife.
Yeah.
It's not, angels and fog. It's the people who die under certain circumstances find themselves back in the place where they died, back in Chicago, in
almost
this case.
Like a purgatory, right?
Almost like, yeah, a purgatory. But I kind of wanted to eschew all the cliches there of there's no indication that they're there to right wrongs or fix their sins. In fact, there's no real indication why they're there at all. And to me, that was part of what was really interesting. We always assume that when we die, we're going to get the answers. Right. If you're a person of faith, you believe one thing. If you don't, you know, if you're not a person of faith, you think it'll just be like going to sleep. And that's an answer, too.
Right.
I kind of love the notion of like, what if you just landed here? No explanation.
It's an adventure.
It's an adventure. Exactly. No rule book. And you have to choose who you're going to be, just like you do in life.
And what I love about the book and you do this so well. But the ability to tell the story of what's happening in the afterlife with this character and also what's happening in the real life and how they intertwine. And even going back to a story from centuries before. And there's a real great way that you chapter this book to be able to tell the story of this afterlife.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. I'm glad it worked for you. To me, part of the thing that was absolutely central was that it was a love story. It's a thriller and it's an attempt to write a modern myth, but more than anything else, it's a love story between these two characters, FBI agents both, who are having a very hot, very illicit relationship. She's his boss, which is kind of a big no-no.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things going on in the city. There's a sniper who's essentially is a terrorist. He's killing people at random. And much like the Beltway snipers in D.C., he has just shut the city down. People are hiding. They're not coming out because of it. So my protagonists are desperately trying to catch this guy all day long and then kind of going back to hide in her apartment at night and pull the universe closed behind them and discover each other.
You know, when you set out to write about the afterlife, because, you know, knowing your story and knowing that when you set out to write a book, you will go follow a detective or, you know, do the you know, find, do research.
Yeah, get pepper spray or attacked by dogs.
Exactly, exactly. But, I mean, when you're writing a book and you're setting out to write something that none of us know anything about, how do you just play off the fact that, you know, your preconceived notion of what the afterlife is like, or is it the same process? I mean, are you going to talk to people in the faith or not faith or dream interpreters? I don't know what it would be.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
I do. Yeah. This one was much more internal. It was much more about wandering through my life and imagining what the place I was in at any given moment would look like in that world and how it would be affected. I'd be out to dinner with my wife, right? And we'd be having a nice dinner. And an idea would occur to me like, wow, this restaurant is too dark. You wouldn't be able to go in here. And I'd sort of spin off. And she'd catch the look on my eyes. She'd be like, you're thinking about the dead people again, aren't you? Like, yeah. I'm sorry. Sorry for date night, baby. I am in fact, thinking about the dead people.
Always thinking about the dead people. Well, I mean, and one of the stirring parts of reading the book is the fact that it is set in modern day Chicago, meaning there are references to certain corners and certain neighborhoods and certain areas, both in reality in this book and both in the afterlife. And you get this idea that it's a little creepy in the way that you're like, wow, I know that intersection. To think that something is happening in the afterlife at that intersection is
good. Yeah,
creepy,
I mean,
right? It's creepy.
Yeah, no, there's nothing I like more than hearing I kind of messed with your head. That was one of the things that I loved when I was thinking about this is imagining this afterlife. It sort of overlays ours. I call it the echo in the book,
yeah.
Because life is the sound and the echo is all that's left afterwards. And I love the notion of these people wandering around as we're wandering around, as we're walking down the sidewalk, there are dead people wandering as well, maybe walking through us, and we're unaware of each other. But the notion that there was also some potential for that world to affect and shape ours was really interesting to me, too.
Marcus Seki in studio, the author of Afterlife, which is out right now, and it was just optioned by Imagine Entertainment. The Chicagoan is in studio. He's going to be at the bookseller signing books on Friday night in Lincoln Square, 7 o'clock start for that. We'll continue the conversation here at the Big Table. Marcus Seki in studio. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio tonight. My guest, Big Table, Chicago novelist Marcus Seki. His new book just released, Afterlife. It was also optioned by Imagine Entertainment. This was a story that just broke the last couple days. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
It's not new territory for you. As I mentioned, almost every book that you've done has been optioned at some point. As you get to this point, do you find yourself wanting more control and less control when you get to the point where you're optioning your books? What are you looking for in an option?
It's been an interesting ride because at first you're just so excited by the notion, and you start mentally casting it, and you're already sitting in the theater in your head. And then you get two or three heartbreaks where it just falls apart, and you learn that the business has a lot of its own rules, and the odds against something actually happening are really high. Only one of my books has been made into a movie. It was my novel, Good People, and it was made mm-hmm. into a movie with James Franco and Kate Hudson. I had no involvement in it at all. They were very courteous. They were nice folks. They sent me the scripts, but I was not involved at all.
So when they send the scripts, you don't write the movie. It's just your story they took.
They just took the story. And then, frankly, by the end of it, they really didn't take that. They took the title. And, I mean, you know, they paid me, so there's only so much I'm going to complain.
Yeah, right, but still, I mean, that's not how you envision it, I'm sure, as an artist. Right?
No, it is not. And, you know, and by the end of the day, I decided that with this one in particular, because it had really consumed me for quite a long time, and because it's such a particular book, right, there's such kind of a distinct feel to it, that I asked when we took it out, I asked my agent if we could try to sell it with me attached to write the screenplay, which is kind of a big get. Usually Hollywood is not all that interested in novelists right. being involved.
If anything, they want to collect the properties. That's what they want, and then they can have their screenwriters write what they need to write.
Exactly, and there's good reason for that. Writing screenplay is a different art than writing a novel. I'm really finding that out myself right now. But, you know, we took it out, and we were fortunate in that there was actually a lot of interest in it, and in particular, Ron Howard and Brian Grazer of Imagine Entertainment loved the book and were completely in on the idea of me writing the screenplay.
I mean, that's got to be something, I mean, terrifying and exciting and exhilarating and all at the same time for you to have such success as a writer, as a novelist, to be 9 books in and to have all these awards and millions of copies sold, and then to be in a position where you're somewhat of a newbie again. Like, you're like, you have to go in and learn how to write. You've got 3 book paperbacks on your desk. How to write a screenplay. Okay, how do I start?
I think you've been in my office, man. That is exactly what my desk looks like.
Emotionally, is that a challenge for you to sort of be starting over?
It absolutely is, but in a really exciting way, too. I mean, dead honestly, in my time as a screenwriter so far, I've spent a lot of time hating the novelist on this book because he just, this guy made it so hard on me. But there's just things that you get to do in a screenplay that are the new colors on your palette, right? It's a different shaped canvas. You're still telling a story, but you're doing it with different tools, and I'm really enjoying playing with them. And I'm really excited to be working with Ron Howard and Brian Grazer, right? I mean, these guys are two of the best in the business, quite literally. And they have a history of taking complicated books and translating them into film. So I'm hoping that they will keep me from screwing it up too badly.
Well, I mean, it's a fascinating transition, because control is a big part of being a novelist. You have an editor, of course, that you trust, but it's your story and you're putting it forward. With writing a screenplay, same concept, I guess, but and there's a lot of edits and rewrites. And
yes.
I mean, some of the great screenwriters who've been in the studio are like, on that movie, there were 46 rewrites of this screenplay. And it's about being open to that. I mean, it's a whole different process of being a writer.
It is completely different process. And you really nailed it. Writing a book is essentially a solitary activity. Your editor may be involved in some level of concepting, but mostly not. Mostly they're helping improve the finished book. I work with a couple of novelist friends, and we'll help each other out when we get stuck on plot problems. But it's essentially, it's your world. It's kind of monotheistic. Writing a screenplay is completely collaborative. From the drop, people have ideas. And it makes sense. I mean, if you're asking someone to drop $80, $100 million on your movie, you can't really ask them to buzz off.
Right. But I mean, there's something, I mean, as an artist, as an author, as someone who is used to one way of doing things, how do you prepare yourself for a 180?
I think part of it is that you're try to be in business with people that you trust and who know more about it than I do. I think for me, while it's a change, it hasn't been too hard thus far to work with others because they know so much more about this.
Yeah.
This is their world and I'm learning, and I'm happy to be thrilled to be learning from the best. So, you know, that part's okay. And then the upside as an artist is beyond just the new tools of writing a screenplay is imagining the upside of the collaboration, right? At the end of the day, an actor or an actress is taking these written words and they are taking it a step further. And that's so exciting
to me.
You know, I mean, if I imagine Emily Blunt reading lines that I've written and just lighting the screen on fire, that's pretty exciting.
That's pretty great. For you, I mean, as someone who's now had pretty much every novel that you've done been optioned, do you start thinking about that process earlier? Do you think when you're doing Afterlife, are you like, okay, I know this is going to be a movie? I mean, does it seep into the consciousness when putting a novel together?
It really doesn't. It really doesn't. I don't think it can. I think I tend to write somewhat cinematically because I've seen a lot of movies, you know, because I love movies. And I think even when it comes to me setting a scene, some part of my brain is almost picturing, you know, where's the point of view? Where's the camera in this? And that's how I see it, and so that's how I describe it. But the notion of writing a book to sell for film, for me at least, that it just wouldn't work.
Yeah, I mean, but at some point when you start to have more experience with writing both the novel and the screenplay, I wonder if you'll be doing it at the same time.
you
know, you're like, today it's about the novel, tomorrow it's about the screenplay.
It sounds like a recipe for madness. picturing myself all Dr. Hacker. Heckle and Josh.
My guest in studio, Marcus Sakey. He is the Chicago novelist. His latest book, Afterlife, is out now. It's just been optioned for film by Imagine Entertainment. He's going to be at the bookseller in Lincoln Park coming up here on Friday, 7 o'clock. Marcus Sakey, my guest tonight. We'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news, and we will continue the conversation here at the big table. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight at the big table, author Marcus Sakey. He, of course, the novelist here in Chicago, award-winning, best-selling author. 9 books, his latest, just Afterlife. Afterlife is out. It's just been optioned as well for film, Imagine Entertainment. And he will be signing Afterlife at the bookseller coming up on Friday night, the bookseller in Lincoln Square, 7 o'clock. You know, I want to talk about Chicago because Chicago plays a huge role. Oh, before I ask the question, let me get a weather update. Doma Tipongo's got a weather update. Severe weather coming through the area. What do you got, bud?
Yeah, Justin, just before you get into it, the National Weather Service issuing a severe thunderstorm warning for northern Kendall County now, western Lake County, in addition to those I mentioned earlier. That includes LaSalle County, southeastern Lee County, DeKalb, and Kane and McHenry. Now remember, McHenry and Kane counties were those already hit with that severe flooding just last week. So we have severe thunderstorms located along a line extending from near Capron to near Kirkland. We're expecting considerable tree damage, damage likely to mobile homes and roofs and outbuildings. So we'll keep our eyes on that this evening.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much for the update. So, yeah, pay attention. That right now it's from 8:30 to about 9:30 right now, but that could change as time goes on. Domati, thank you very much. All right, back to Marcus Sakey in studio. You're a Chicagoan, and you set your work in Chicago. Why do you do that? I mean, because you could have a lot of variety in being a fiction writer, novelist. What is it about Chicago that sort of is the right backdrop for your stories?
Well, I mean, I have to admit there are times in February when I think I should set up in Thailand or Tahiti. I love Chicago. I love writing about Chicago. Part of it is that it's just such a live, vibrant city. It strikes me as a really American city, where I feel like some other cities are, you know, New York is fashion and finance, and L.A. is Hollywood and yoga. Chicago feels like America to me, kind of warts and all. I mean, there are a lot of problems in this city too, but that's part of what makes it feel alive.
Well, I mean, you are writing crime fiction, and so there's a lot of work surrounding police and detectives and detective work. And like I mentioned earlier, I mean, you know, you do a lot of research. I mean, you talked about this before, but in a lot of your work, you do ride-alongs and try to get into the mind of Chicago characters.
It's really important to me, partly to get the details right, and then partly, honestly, because it's just enormous fun. I've done a lot of ride-alongs with CPD, with different divisions of it, with beat cops and homicide detectives and gang intelligence. When I was writing my first book, actually, at this point, I had no credentials whatsoever. I was just a guy writing a book. And I wanted to know what would happen if you dumped a body in the river. So I called CPD. And I said, so to be clear, this is not an emergency. And I don't have a body, but I'm a guy writing a book. And they transferred me around for about an hour until I got to News Affairs, and I talked to Pat Camden over there, and he was really generous. He sat on the phone with me for an hour explaining what would happen if I dumped a body in the river, and you know whose responsibility it would fall under, and he made jokes about cops would line up on either side throwing rocks trying to push the body to the other side so it was somebody else's. And I mean, there's just details like that you can't get any other way.
When you do a ride along, and what are you looking for? I mean, are you looking for the way that the police officers talk? Are you looking for background so you better understand the job? If you're writing a protag that's a detective, what are you looking for when you try to ride along with someone in real life?
It's two things for me. It's the little details. It's what they wear on their belt and how they wear it. It's that every homicide cop, they're not in uniform, right? They're in suits. So when they stop for coffee or a sandwich, they always put their radio on the table so that the staff knows they're cops and they get their food free or half off. And it's just, that's like that kind of detail slays me. And then the other thing, honestly, is stories. I just, there's always a period when I'm riding along with cops, 20, 30 minutes, where they're not quite sure about me, right? They don't know if I'm actually a journalist, if I'm out to do an expose.
Yeah, a hit piece or something, right?
Right, exactly. And they pick up pretty quickly that is not what I'm doing, that I want a sense of the world and I want to hear them talk. And once they do, they start telling stories. And we usually end the night just howling with laughter. I mean, cops have the best stories you will ever hear.
Do you find yourself... I mean, is that part of it too? I mean, because you want to get the good stories out of police officers, that you almost have to develop such a quick relationship with these guys because they are guarded. I mean, they're not going to. I would think if I were a police officer and they're like, "Hey, Justin, this guy Marcus wants to ride along," I'd be like, "Yeah,
not
looking forward to this."
Well, and to be fair, at this point, I've got a track record, and cops can call other cops and ask about me, and you know, I've got the books out, so I think that helps. I think right now, with everything that's going on in the city, it would probably be a little harder to break
different,
through that
right,
shell.
Right.
But I've found overall, I've had a lot of experience talking to people in very odd jobs and having them show me their jobs. And I mean, I've I've gone rappelling with SWAT teams. I've held slices of human brain, you know, with a medical examiner. I've gone diving for pirate treasure.
And you've done a lot of this with Hidden City.
I did a lot of this with a television show, called Hidden City, a short-lived television show that was mostly about me being heard on television. Like that really should have been the pitch. The producer was a I'm going to say friend of mine, but if you hear air quotes, it's because. For the very first episode, we decided I should be pepper sprayed. And the thing, as the pepper spray hits me across both eyes and my head just rocks backwards, as that happens, and only then, it occurs to me that we are doing this for the sizzle reel to help sell the show. So I'm not even getting paid. It's
the
only
things you
as
do
it,
for entertainment.
As
right?
it hits back, I'm like, I just did that for free.
Marcus Sakey in studio with me tonight at the big table. Detail. You know, you mentioned it just about the police officers putting the radio up on the table as a signal, other stories, but also, you know, description. How important is it for you to be right? To have these things right when you're writing a crime fiction, especially one set in Chicago? Because, you know, when I'm reading even Afterlife, and there's it's about FBI agents, and even the point of when they're early on in the book doing investigations and putting things together. How important is it for you to be right?
I think my wife would tell you it's really important to me to be right. honestly, jokes aside, it's important to me. I feel like if I want to keep people up late and I want them to think about the book after, the keeping them up late, there's just tricks you can use, right? But making something that lingers with someone mm-hmm. that they think about, that's a matter of respect. And part of that respect means that I'm not just totally stringing you along. You know, I want to get the details right. I really strive to. There are occasions where it just makes more sense to make up an intersection, or to change something like that. But with something like the FBI, where there are procedures and there are habits and there are books about it, and I know FBI agents, it seems to me irresponsible not to just ask questions.
Do you find in when you option a book to film, to Hollywood, or in this case, write it yourself, to screenplay, do you find yourself having to cut corners on detail, or do you double down on detail? I mean, because for a good point would be like if you were going to do that scene of the police officers with their radio, that's much more descriptive in actual seeing it, like the idea of, or, you know, it might not be necessary to the plot of what you're trying to get at in a shortened sort of version in the screenplay.
I think the answer to that is sort of yes, you do both. You cut them out and you double down on it. So when I talk about there being new tools in screenwriting, I can just show cops walking into a diner and they both just consciously set their radios on the table and continue whatever conversation they're having. I might not call out why they do it. Or I might have a scene where whoever's serving them food sees the radio and takes the bill away, if I want to make the point. But it's unlikely that I'm going to hit that hard, but I get to show it instead of saying it.
Right.
And so I think it's a matter of you pick the ones that are more visual and then the ones that matter more. And you have to let a lot wash away. I mean, the book's almost 400 pages. A screenplay is 110, and most of that is white space. Yeah. The goal is to find the essential truths of the thing and then be okay with letting a lot of the rest of it, not be present.
When you're writing crime fiction based in Chicago, do you develop a certain affinity for language? And what I mean by that is certain words, certain descriptors that play to the city. You know, there might be a little bit more blue collar, that might be a little bit more colloquial in the way that, you know, it's how it's said in Chicago. Do you find yourself gravitating towards the word?
I do. Very much. I mean, I love language as music. My favorite writers really write with a poetic sensibility that is almost musical. You know, an Aaron Sorkin or an Elmore Leonard. These guys, they just make the language sing, and they make you hear the person with such clarity. And a lot of that is word choice. For me, I try not to get buried in colloquialisms. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I try to pull out the one or two things that are accurate, and do more of it with rhythm and overall word choice.
for you, as we wrap up here, I mean, you've got the job to be the screenwriter on your own. you asked for it, you get it. What does a future look like for you? I mean, is it a short term kind of thing where you push yourself to do a project a year, or do you have yourself in any sort of discipline like that, or is it sort of when the inspiration hits you, you work on a new project?
Oh no, it can't be about when inspiration hits. It's a job. I mean, it's a great job. It's the job I've wanted my whole life, but you have to treat it like a job. The best piece of advice I give aspiring writers is butt in chair, fingers on keyboard. You know, wait for inspiration and muses and things like that. So for me, I'm very, very grateful that this is what I get to do. It's what I've wanted to do since I was 5 years old. I love it. And my goal is just to be able to keep doing it and to keep telling big stories that excite me and scare me and, you know, distract me during date nights with my wife.
Author Marcus Sakey, Chicagoan, Chicago novelist. His new book is called Afterlife. He's going to be signing it at Bookseller up in Lincoln Square on Friday night, 7 o'clock. The book was optioned by Imagine Entertainment, and you are writing the screenplay for that as well. So we will look for that movie on the big screen in the near future. Marcus Sakey, thanks so much for coming in and talking tonight.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a ball.
Always liked that guy, Marcus Sakey. And I've never had a chance to sit down and talk to him. And his book, Afterlife, is tremendous. You could see it, Pete. You could see it as a movie. It's got movie vibe to it. You know, when it's essentially an FBI guy who is chasing a mastermind criminal. I don't want to give it away, but then he ends up in the afterlife. And in it, instead of it being, like he said, rosy, weird unicorns and fog and angels, as we kind of have, you know, depicted it over time, it's essentially the same world, and but it's populated by, you know, like all sorts of souls, good and bad ones. And so it's almost like an adventure. He doesn't know where he's at, what's happening, and it becomes like Escape from New York, essentially. You know what I mean?
Who do you see playing the FBI guy?
I think it could be like a...
Is it a young guy?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a hero. You know what I mean? Like, it could be like, only because of World War Z, I think Brad Pitt.
Oh.
You know, kind of the same concept. Like, what do you do to get out of here? And he's like, there's a scene early on. They're trying to find, like he mentioned, they're trying to find a sniper. And the sniper, like, snipes. Is that what they do? They snipe.
Shoot.
They shot at an EMT where he was at, and he runs after the sniper with no worry that he might get sniped. You know what I mean? Like that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. So he's like a little bit reckless, and he gets too close. Like he's on the trail. He gets too close and he gets, I don't want to give it away.
Does it got to be a Chicago guy though?
Like a Dennis Franz? I don't know. I don't know.
A Joe Montaigne.
Yeah. Like a swimmer.
Oh yeah, like reinventing himself.
Yeah, it's good. I like it. I think it's got legs. And I think, like I said, I mean, there's a whole thing. There's a lot in it. So, but Marcus Sakey, and it's funny because he was there at Printer at Litfest, and he was on the list of people I wanted to bring in for that. If you remember that monumental 2 days where we did like nine books, nine authors,
yeah.
Which I'm still I think
the stack,
I still have headaches. And I remember saying, all right, well, maybe we'll take him off the list because he's going to have new stuff coming out and he's in Chicago. So it worked out that I had a little bit more time and we can have him and we can stretch out. So it was good. Marcus Sakey at the Bookseller coming up on Friday night. We transition to one of the biggest names in music. I was going to say in film, in commentary. I'm not even sure if you can just call me musician anymore. Mogul.
The biggest name in the entertainment industry.
He's by I would assume that my next guest is probably the biggest star we've had on the download. Ice Cube in studio coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. He is the owner, the co-owner of the new 3-on-3 professional basketball league, which you've probably heard a lot about, not just here but just all over. He's making the rounds.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's funny because today I was going through all of the interviews and, you know, to research on Cube. And it's all about, like, it's just like every city they stop in, it's, you know, the local sports reporter talking to Cube, asking him about reflecting on NWA. So my turn.
Yeah, why not? Yeah,
right. But yeah, the 3-on-3 basketball league is coming to the UIC Pavilion on Sunday. So Ice Cube in studio. I mean, awesome. You know, because a lot of times you get these guys on the phone, and that's good. I like doing the phone. It's great to talk to them. But there's something better, and we all know about the chemistry of being able to sit down. So looking forward to that. And, I mean, what perfect timing. The Defiant Ones on HBO, the first two episodes, Cube's all over it. I mean, there's a whole storyline. It's fascinating stuff about money. I mean, it's funny because the Straight Outta Compton movie kind of fictionalized all this stuff, so you kind of know it, but this is the historical account with actual Dre and Cube talking about it and stuff like that. So it's kind of great, you know, just to think about, you know, there was this interviews that these guys did, and there's a great line that Dre has in Defiant Ones where he talks about when they broke up and how they sort of started to beef, NWA started to beef, Ice Cube versus NWA, if you remember that, and how it was like sprinkling powder, like how do you say it, gunpowder and ego. Like, just when you get fame, that's what he was saying, and as he was talking now. It's like you're talking with fame on top of ego, it's like gunpowder. You know, it's a powder keg in the way that you don't even start rationally thinking anymore because your ego's been bruised and fame is on top of it. So you start doing things that you normally wouldn't. It just gets bigger than it should on both sides. So that was a thing. But yeah, so that's coming up. We'll talk
great
about Ice Cube. And then tonight, Swap Meet. Greg Flam back in studio. This is the segment 312-981-7200 where we, of course, evaluate your collectibles, your memorabilia, your junk.
I wonder if he's going to bring in some 90s hip-hop cassettes.
Oh, man, I should have reached out to him and said, you got any NWA memorabilia, you know, that you could bring in? I'm sure that's all over the estate sales of the western suburbs.
I have this Raiders hat. I don't know if that counts.
A lot of Kings.
Oh yeah, was it the Kings?
Yeah, the LA Kings. I mean, I'm sure there was some. I don't think they were big hockey fans.
I remember the inconsistency in the NWA movie where in Straight Outta Compton where they had the White Sox cap, but right. it was years before that logo came out.
Yeah, they didn't have the red, white, and blue, like the Sox, like Robotron Sox logo. They had the more, you know,
yeah,
sort of stylized S, black and white S, but that didn't come out till 1993 or something like that.
And then that one scene where they talked about Yoan Moncada, and they were like, "Wait a minute, he hasn't even been born yet."
What?
He grounded out to first. It looked like in the second AB.
Well, this is going to be the problem, right? Was we're going to get all excited to watch them lose. And tonight the Dodgers are making fast work of the Sox. All right, coming up after the news, Ice Cube. Yeah. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is one of the owners of the new Big Three Basketball League, which is coming to the UIC Pavilion this Sunday. The professional league is 3-on-3 basketball, and it features former NBA stars who are both playing and coaching some of the greats like Allen Iverson, Dr. J, Charles Oakley. It's the brainchild of actor, writer, and musician Ice Cube. It's not hyperbole to say that Cube is one of the greatest artists of a generation. He came up with the group NWA. He's got a tremendous and influential solo career, the groundbreaking record Death Certificate, just celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. He's acted in movies like Boys in the Hood and Friday, the latter, the movie that Ice Cube co-wrote. Friday still holds up as one of the funniest comedies of all time. Ice Cube in town for the Big Three games at the UIC Pavilion this Sunday. It's a quadruple header starting at 2 p.m., and he is in studio tonight on the Download. Ice Cube, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
Yeah. So what got you to be interested in 3-on-3 basketball?
Well, I mean, I've been interested in 3-on-3 basketball ever since I was a kid, you know, just growing up. I think most of us play a lot of 3-on-3. More 3-on-3 than full court.
Right.
So it's something that's like on the underground in the fabric of basketball. You know, it's most of our introduction into basketball is 3-on-3. So, you know, I always wonder why it wasn't a professional version of 3-on-3 basketball.
What makes it better than the game that we see on television, a 5-on-5 game? What makes 3-on-3 a better sport or version of basketball?
Well, I think it's faster. I think, you know, without all that running, I think in 5-on-5 you can hide. There's places you can hide, and you know, with 3-on-3 you have to show up, you know, because it's mano a mano, you know, it's skill level. Right. You have to D up. It's pretty much man-on-man defense. So, you know, you really have to show your true skills. And so I just feel like it's a different game. And, you know, it's played more than 5-on-5.
Yeah.
You know, 3-on-3 is actually the most played form of team basketball in the world. So I just feel like we have great rules. We have 14-second shot clock, which gets things moving pretty quick. Our free throws are unique. One free throw for the shot. So if you was taking a two-pointer, we got one free throw for 2 points. If you were taking a three-pointer, one free throw for 3 points. And if you were taking a four-pointer, yep, we got a four-pointer. One shot for 4 points. And we just feel that speeds up the game, and it's not become a free throw fest.
For you, there's a lot that you could put your name on. There's a lot of products. There's a lot of art. There's a lot of things, entertainment to put on. You're involved in a lot of different things. What is it about? It's one thing to like 3-on-3 basketball, but what does it mean to actually start a league, to put your name, Ice Cube, on a 3-on-3 basketball league?
Well, it's a big endeavor. You know, it's one of the biggest things I've ever tried to accomplish. And, you know, it's not just me. I have some great people working with me. Co-founder, Jeff Quantinance, who's my partner. We've been doing stuff for 20 years. And Amy Trask, who used to run the Raiders. She was the CEO with the Raiders for over 30 years, dealing with Al Davis. So now she's dealing with me.
Now she's dealing with you.
You know what I mean? It's not too much different. Roger Mason Jr., who's our commissioner. He was the number two. Yeah, former Bull. But he was the number two at the NBA PA. So by him leaving that job and coming over to be our commissioner was a big deal. So, you know, we have some great people to pull this off, and people I haven't mentioned behind the scenes. And, you know, it's been a giant endeavor, but it's been very, very satisfying.
Well, this is week six. I mean, you're coming into the UIC
week five, yeah.
Coming into the UIC Pavilion here. Mm-hmm. You know, what has been the challenge for a league like this? You get a lot of press, a lot of, I saw the ESPN piece, and people are talking about Allen Iverson's been a great ambassador for you guys. You, of course, being doing a lot of press on this. What has been the challenge as the creator of a professional league 5 weeks in?
Time has been our challenge. You know, we just launched in January. We just let the world know we were here in January, and then we had games coming. So, you know, we've promoted, we've marketed, and we've created a league all at the same time. So it's been, you know, monumental to be able to pull this off. And we're really starting to see success when it comes to our television numbers. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going in the right direction.
Fox Sports 1,
which is up. And it's just great that people have bought into our version of 3-on-3 basketball.
You know, 3-on-3 basketball, as you mentioned, is the most played version of the sport, and you see it in tournaments all the time. You always see it in Chicago in the summertime, people playing outside. As you look at this version of basketball, is the goal to compete with the NBA? I mean, again, former NBA stars who've retired or are playing. I mean, is the goal to essentially grab a basketball fan for Fox Sports 1, to grab a basketball fan to come to the UIC Pavilion? I mean, is this a straight-up competition for the National Basketball Association?
I don't think so. I think we're a complementary league. You know, I don't think we're a competitive league. We're playing a totally different form of basketball. And the NBA is great. We love for the NBA to be as successful as it can be because, you know, the players that we have are former NBA players who can't play the NBA schedule, or I guess GMs think they can't play the NBA schedule.
That's right.
So, you know, we feel like we're here after you finish with your career in the NBA. You have to be over 30 to get in our league.
So, you see that changing at any point? You see yourself saying, you know what, this is successful. Let's start getting kids out of college. Let's try to go younger.
Well, that's, we don't want to do that. We want to, you know, I think if we start doing that, we are in direct competition.
Right.
But by us being here after your professional NBA career is over, I feel like we're, you know, a compliment to the league. And, you know, that's great. You know, we don't want to do anything to hurt the NBA. The NBA has been great, and I'm a fan of the NBA, still is. So we just want to make sure that we can give guys something to do in the summer, fans something to do, fun competitive basketball in the summer with guys that you still want to see play.
As you mentioned, this is the biggest endeavor that you've taken on, which is hard to believe. I mean, you've done so many things, but you're right. I mean, you've created brand, you've marketed a ton, you of course created so much content in your life. As an entrepreneur, as someone who is a creator, and when you've got the people around you, mm-hmm. what do you take away from that as essentially a creator and owner of a league? And what are the things that you take away as a business person?
Well, you know, I just want to make sure that we have great basketball, great product, you know, because what you don't want to be is the jack of all trades, master of none. And so we want to make sure that it's as good as it can be and that people are happy when they leave. And I think, you know, we provide a unique experience at a basketball game. You know, four games in one day, you can't really beat that. And you're seeing 48 of your favorite NBA stars, NBA. But they're guys you know, guys who we've seen come through high school, college, pros. They're part of our sports fabric or sports family, and then they disappear. But no more. You know, now they can, if they want to come back and get on the hardwood and compete with their peers,
they can.
We have the big three.
Ice Cube in studio tonight on The Download. We're talking about the Big Three, which is going to be in Chicago, the 3-on-3 Professional Basketball League. It'll be here at the UIC Pavilion coming up on Sunday, July 23rd. It's going to start at 2 o'clock. We'll continue the conversation with Ice Cube here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. My guest in studio, Ice Cube, who just messed around, got a triple-double, and then started a professional 3-on-3 league.
Yeah. Hopefully it'd be a good day like it was in the song.
Ice Cube, of course, the co-owner of the Big Three Basketball League, which is coming to the UIC Pavilion this Sunday, week 5, featuring former NBA stars, coaches and players, both Allen Iverson, been a big part of this.
Yeah.
Charles Oakley coming into town, back to town in Chicago.
Without a doubt.
Love to have him back
we
here.
We got Kendall Gill on
Kendall
the squad
Gill, yeah.
now. You know, he didn't get drafted at first, but he's been picked up out the draft pool. And so it's been cool to see guys take it serious, go at it, you know, Rashard Lewis, Mike Bibby, you know, Chauncey Billups, Jermaine O'Neal, Steven Jackson, Kenyon Martin.
All the players, the players we grew up with.
Without a doubt.
Does this take all your time now? You're touring because, you know, I know you came through on the 25th anniversary of Death Certificate. Are you a mogul right now, a basketball mogul and artist second?
Yes. I got basketball on the brain. And it's a trip because I'm used to having a promoter and coming in town, just show up. You know what I mean? Just go to the hotel, kick back. Don't have to worry about nothing but my show. Hit the stage, do my thing, and go home. Now, you know, being the promoter, you have to set the stage. You worry about tickets. You worried about...
That's why you're here, right?
You know, insurance and taxes and this, that, and the other. So it's definitely a different thing to set the stage, but I enjoy, once the stage is set, to sit back and watch the games.
You know, I think of your career, and you've worn so many hats, as I mentioned in the lead for this, you know, being a part of NWA, being a solo rapper, but also an actor, a great actor, and a writer. I mean, you're writing screenplays, not to mention all the other things you do in your career. How much of, and take us to the beginning, how much of Ice Cube, when you started in NWA, how much of it was a character? How much of it was a performance, and how much of it was real life?
Well, it was all real to me. To me, it was about doing rhymes and raps that people could relate to, because I knew I could relate to them. And, you know, we kind of grabbed our niche and our style and we ran with it. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was about creating those experiences on audio in the studio. It was about recreating what we had seen growing up and going through. And so it was still, still art. It was still creative. And that's what turned me on about it, that we were making stuff from scratch. And that still is what turns me on after all these years, is to create things that the world
that haven't been created before.
And to be able to see it, you know, become successful is the icing on the cake.
You know, it's funny, I'm watching Defiant Ones on HBO, and you've got a storyline in there that's a great documentary that's on HBO right now. There was funny because I forgot who was talking. There was Dre was talking about, like, we were putting everyone together, and we had Cube. He was the angry rapper. He said that at one point, like, that was the narration of someone talking about the putting it together, the angry rapper. And I thought about that, and I was like, do you agree with that? That was your persona? You were the angry rapper? That's sort of what you were in the beginning stages of your career?
Well, you know, I felt like I had all kind of different styles, you know. I was funny, too, you know. You know, that's kind of his perception. But for me, I didn't look at myself as that. I didn't call myself the angry rapper. I remember UTFO had a guy in their group called the Educated Rapper. And, you know, that was very specifically, you know, pointed out. But I never used that phrase a day in my life. You know, I just rapped about what I thought was great and what was dope and creative and what the world didn't have already. So that's what it was really about.
I think about all the storylines around, and you know, watching the Defiant Ones, it's brought right back to you the storylines, the beefs, the conflicts that came out of it. And just for the record, I was on your side on all the beefs. I just want to make that clear.
You was on the right side. That's a good thing.
But I just wonder, I mean, how important is storyline in entertainment? For you to have someone to beef with, someone to have conflict with. I mean, of course, we all know what happened where it kind of got too big. But the idea of how important is it for art and rap music to have a foil, to have someone that you have to go against?
Well, I think it's something that's not required in hip-hop. But when hip-hop is great, it happens. You know, it's like if it's contrived, it's not going to be good. But if it's real and if it's something that's really there, it's great. So it's, you know, like I said, not a requirement of hip-hop, but it is hip-hop at its best. So I don't think anybody goes around looking for beef, except maybe 50 Cent, you know, going after Ja Rule. But for the most part.
But he used it as well. I mean, that catapulted him.
So. It could be used, but I think it has to always come from a real place, or it's sniffed out like, you know, wrestling or something. You know what I mean? It has to be authentic for it to do its magic.
The reason I ask, I think about in our society right now, we have a president who likes the beef. You know what I mean? Yeah. He's sort of beefing with everybody around him. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think about the storylines and narratives. I mean, he's a guy from entertainment. He's done this for a long time. Yeah. And he seems to borrow a page from hip-hop and what made hip-hop so successful in the late 80s and 90s when you were at the helm.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I think, you know, there's always, you know, people been beefing way before hip-hop. So, you know, to me, you got to respect somebody who stand up for themselves, you know. And, you know, that's the kind of neighborhood I come from, and you got to stand up for yourself. So if that's what he's doing, it's just weird when it's the president.
Yeah, right.
But it's not weird when you're a man that just is not going to take it.
You know, I mentioned at the top, I am a huge fan of the movie Friday. What you did with that and being a co-writer on that, it was, again, trendsetting. It's something that wasn't done before.
Thank you.
For you to be an artist coming out at that point where you had already had success so much in so many different fields, how do you avoid in showbiz being typecast as a gangster rapper? Or, you know, like Boys in the Hood, you were tremendous.
Yeah.
But a lot of America would say, well, that he's familiar with that. That's how he grew up. How do you get out of a showbiz typecast?
I think it's a fine line, because if you have something unique, then in a way you want to be typecast. You know, you want to see Robert De Niro in gangster movies. You know what I mean? You just want to see it because he's so good. But, you know, being a young black artist, you got to be careful because typecasting can get you out the business. So, you know, I just, you know, turned down roles that were right in my wheelhouse.
Were there a lot of roles being thrown at you at that point? Like after Boys in the Hood, where people like, he can act? Oh, we want you to play this gangster, or this gangster.
I mean, I was asked to be a Menace to Society. You know what I mean? But I turned that role down because it was just so much like Boys in the Hood to me. It was a lateral move, and it wasn't a move in any direction. So I just tried to avoid those lateral moves and just, you know, I move in a different direction and try to, you know, establish myself as somebody you can bank on. You're like, if you see an Ice Cube movie, most of the time it's not going to be a waste of your money or it's not going to be a waste of your time. It's going to be at least worth a watch.
I think of you as a disruptor. There's so much. We talk on the show a lot about business startup owners and people in the tech business, and they're finding different ways to improve upon things. And I think in the music industry and the entertainment industry, you've always been a disruptor. You've disrupted with NWA. You changed the game from the music industry and its whole. I think about that, and I also think of how many people, myself included, 16, 17-year-old white kid from Wonder Lake, Illinois, who fell in love with Ice Cube. Stories of the streets said I couldn't relate to it. It wasn't the same kind of experience, but it was rebellion. You were the Elvis Presley for a generation. Do you think about it that way? I mean, do you think about the idea of the way that you spoke to people, even if it wasn't, we couldn't relate to your stories of growing up in South Central, we understood the rebellious nature of your music.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't like grow up and say, you know, what am I going to disrupt today? I mean, you know what I mean? I don't wake up and say that. But it's all about being yourself, and it's all about doing what you feel and not doing what was done yesterday or not worrying about what was done yesterday, because today is a new day. So, you know, I try to not worry about standards, traditions, you know, here's how we do it over here kind of way of thinking. I just think about what needs to be done and what should be done and what I want to do, and it gives you a fearless mentality, because at the end of the day, you know, it's all creation. At the end of the day, it's all communication. It's communication between humans. And you know, if you can get a better understanding listening to Ice Cube or checking out one of my movies on stuff you don't know about, then I did my job. You know, I know you don't know about South Central Los Angeles, but hopefully you have a little understanding about what it's like. And to me, that's what it's all about. When it's all said and done, that's what it's all about.
You know, my last question just is the 25th anniversary of Death Certificate, the seminal record. I mean, a tremendous achievement. I was listening to it today. Same themes could be applied to 2017 that were applied 25 years ago.
I'm
sitting here in a studio in Chicago. You know, when you think about the themes that you were rapping about on that record, even stuff in NWA, and you think about the current situation in places like Chicago, south and west sides of Chicago, do you feel like the situation's improved at all, or do you feel like your music, it's the same kind of message today than it was 25 years ago?
You know, I feel like society takes one step forward and then two steps back, you know, and that's been happening as long as I've been alive. And it's sad that 25 years later, the record is current. And I remember listening to What's Going On by Marvin Gaye. And it was the 80s, and he had done that in the 60s? Was it 60s?
Yeah, 70, yeah.
And it was the 80s, and it was the same situation. I was like, man, this song, this record could have been made today. And I'm saying this in 88, 89. You know what I mean? And I'm like, yo, this record could be made today because we having the same problems.
Yeah.
Little did I know that I would do a record, and 25 years later, people would say, yo, this record could be made today because we have the same problems. And it's sad, but it's the reason why artists are great and good and why we need them to continue to pump out what they feel and stay creative and not conform to all these different ways to make money.
Ice Cube is the co-owner of the Big Three Basketball League. The league is coming to the UIC Pavilion this Sunday. for week five of the season. It's inaugural season. Greats will be on the court, as we mentioned. Kendall Gill, others from Chicago will also be in attendance. Allen Iverson, Dr. J. Charles Oakley. A ton of players are involved with this league, more than 40 players in total. It'll be UIC Pavilion, 2 o'clock this Sunday. Ice Cube, I can't thank you enough for coming in and talking about your career and the league with us tonight on The Download.
Oh, man, it was a great interview. And you got to come out Sunday, man. You know, you won't have more fun at a basketball game than at the Big Three. So I got a ticket for you, a couple of tickets for you and your folks over here. And,
all right.
Come hang out with us, man. Have fun.
Can we start now?
Let's go.
Straight out of Compton.
Thanks, Doma T. Download here at 720 WGN. Severe weather coming through the area. Continues to pound. I'm getting reports from Naperville and out west that the it's torrential, that it's coming down hard. If you're in the way of the storm, seek cover. 630 says torrential rain. Streets are still passable, but it doesn't look like it's letting up. Other 630 said... taken cover, getting our butts kicked here in Naperville. So a lot of reports coming in from Naperville and the sort of areas in DuPage about this storm that's coming through. Severe weather on its way through the area. So and from reports, I mean, this is what the services, one of the National Weather Service saying, 60 to 70 miles per hour winds being reported as this line of storms moves across north and central Illinois. This is from the National Weather Service. Those in the path, please take cover. So just for those who are in the path or in it right now, it is a strong storm with some serious wind. When you're talking 60 to 70 miles per hour, that's some serious wind. So take cover in that area. Try to seek shelter if you can. Of course, those who are in the Chicago area, Cook County, it's coming this way. As I think about Michigan Avenue right now, as people are walking freely with no precipitation yet, winds of that nature. But it's coming this way, so be prepared. But for those that are in the path of the storm right now, this would be people in Elgin, listeners in DuPage County, even for Kane County as well. 60 to 70 miles per hour wind being reported. Rain and lightning in Grays Lake area. And like Doma T was saying, I mean, this is exacerbates a situation that is difficult for some in McHenry, Kane, Lake County, who just went through the painful process and continuing to go through the painful process of cleaning up after floods along the Fox and Des Plaines Rivers, as well as basements and other areas. So severe weather coming through. Of course, this seems to be a storm that might be different in the way that it's just very dangerous in terms of the winds, not like it was last week where it was dangerous because it was 8 inches of rain like that. But at the same time, I mean, it's 847 says the winds are calmer in Grays Lake, but going to get more flooding tonight. I just out of the corner of my eye look left, like to the TV. We have a little TV in the studio in the White Sox game. The Dodgers are blowing out the White Sox. But they had a shot of the audience. You know, because the other thing that Don Matisse said as well, this idea that, you know, if you're at the guaranteed rate, the storm is coming. So it's probably a good idea if they're in the bottom of the sixth inning, it's a blowout. I know you want to get value out of your ticket, but it might be good to start thinking about future plans, short-term future plans. But you look, they had a shot at the audience, and it was Adam Hogue watching the game.
Yeah, I saw that he was there. He was excited to catch a Moncada home run.
Yeah, I don't know where he was sitting, but they just had a – I don't think they were talking about him. It was just a shot of the audience, and he was there. So there you go.
Yeah, if you're there at the game, Moncada will probably be on the White Sox for 15, 18 years. You can leave, get home safely.
Right. Anyway, so the severe weather coming through as we speak. We'll keep you updated on that. All right, we'll take a break here. We'll come back. And coming up, Greg Flamm, Swap Meet. Stay with us. Did you hear in the Ice Cube interview that I had a nice little shout out to Wonder Lake, Illinois? I don't know if you noticed that. The town in which I grew up, you wouldn't think necessarily would be a Ice Cube bastion, like the center of Ice Cube fandom. But I'm telling you, me, Stu, Ad Rock, Adam, loved Ice Cube. That's about it right there. Three of the people in the area. But I have to say, it was a pleasure to think back to my days as a, I don't even know, like 15, 16-year-old, and to be listening to NWA or listening to Ice Cube and feeling like I've discovered something that I would never actually discover, you know? And then trying to, like, taking that and having to deal with, I mean, there's some, I always think about it, you know, like I tried to ask him about the idea of white kids in faraway lands. And I think of Wonder Lake being a prime example, in their bedroom listening to NWA tapes. Not necessarily who they thought was probably going to buy that music. Yet, if you go to an Ice Cube concert, you saw him, I think he was in one of the first two Lollapaloozas, you know, or whenever Ice Cube's on stage, a majority of the audience is going to be white. And kind of asking him how he feels about that. I thought his answer was really great. His answer was, you know, about the this idea, if I can, through my music, communicate an experience that you don't know about, or a way that somebody else in this world, another human being, lives, then I'm doing my job. And I thought that to be, I mean, and I think it's vice versa. Like, I always think about, like, what is it? Or what was it? I guess what is it? What was it about an NWA tape that attracted so many suburban, rural white kids to it? It can't be that. I mean, I think it's too simple to be like, you want to be rappers, or you know, or you want to, what do they say, adopt the culture of African Americans or sort of street culture. I think it has all to do with rebellion. I think in our culture, there's always a place for, well, when you get this opportunity as a teenager to listen to people rebelling. And I think of, Elvis Presley. He made his whole name on that, right? The Beatles, in a way, were like that.
I like the swear words. It was like, oh man, they're using some.
These are some serious swear words.
Yeah.
And they don't care. And they're pointed. You know, it's not just swear words. I mean, there's some lazy swear words. These were pointed swear words.
Yeah.
They're pointing them at, you know, judges and authority figures, whether you like it or not. I'm not saying it's right, but I'm just saying that's what they were doing. And you're like, say what you will. And I'm not trying to argue the merits of NWA, but there is something great about America in the way that can be a thing without oppression or government bodies coming down and say, you can't talk like that. And I think at a certain point, it opens up your worldview to a way that you realize that, you know, there are other ways to to approach and protest what's happening around the world, and even opening up to injustices that you don't even think about, or you do think about, and at the end of the day, you don't know how to articulate it. So anyway, I just think about that, like listening to Ice Cube. So great. So great. Like, it's so great meeting him. I told him the story when we were done. I was like, hey, a couple of my buddies, we would come in and see you from Wonder Lake, Illinois. And he's like, all right. So I know those living and listening right now in Wonder Lake are like, really? People in Wonder Lake were carpooling to go see Ice Cube at the Riviera? We were. It was some McHenry guys too, but we were. Yeah. But yeah, and I love him. I feel like the movie Friday is brilliant. You watch the movie Friday, and I think it diluted a little bit in the way that, because there were like 10 sequels to it. But the original movie with Chris Tucker, launched Chris Tucker, and Ice Cube playing a role in which he was just Craig. I mean, it's still referenced today.
Oh, yes.
No Problems, Chance the Rapper, the single off of his album, has a reference to Craig, how Craig did Debo, or, you know, the fight at the end of Friday. So, I mean, it's still a relevant piece of pop culture that continues to be referenced today in 2017.
I always remember Michael Jordan saying that it was his favorite movie of all time. I like that.
There you go. 847 said, where's Wonder Lake? What do you mean, where's Wonder Lake? That is offensive. There are 8,000 people that are offended right now. No, it's about 90 miles, maybe a little less, 90 miles northwest of downtown Chicago, about 15 minutes from Woodstock, McHenry in McHenry County, about 15, 20 minutes from the Wisconsin border. That's where I grew up.
It's been a while since we've been out that way. Yeah, take the show back.
Yeah,
there.
I was going to say, we went out there, Pete and I went out there to Crystal Lake, which is kind of like that's the big city of the area, mm-hmm. to do a show at Duke's back in the wintertime. I think we need to venture further in. I think we need to go further in instead of stopping at Crystal Lake. We keep going. Thelma and Louise style. We're not going to run out of gas. Maybe get to McHenry, do a show at the old Village Squire. Is the Village Squire still there? Or get out to Wonder Lake and do something on the Horizons patio. I don't know if any of these places are still there. Across from the funeral home, Horizons. Would they be up for a live broadcast of the download, 7 to 11? We should have done it on the 4th of July, because they have the party in Wonder Lake on the 4th of July, because they do boast the number one, if I don't know if it's number one, but they boast a ski team, water ski team, because they have the lake there. So they have a water ski team that's like really good. Or like I said, a water ski team. I don't know. Too many people have an actual water ski team, but that's the thing. So then you go see it right at like dusk, and you see, you know, a young team do jumps off, you know, on cool speedboats, and then the fireworks are after that.
You got to take that over and be the MC.
I know. I was a little upset that I didn't get a call from the Wonder Lake Chamber of Commerce. It's like, Mr. Kaufman, we'd love to have you come on out here and be the Grand Marshal of the Wonder Lake Parade. Not for the WGN part, but just because, I mean, Wonder Lake Little League, I was something. You know, they should remember that. That's the big part of the 4th of July parade. The Little League teams get to walk.
Yeah, they remember that game where you were afraid to go in and pitch.
They must remember that.
You talked about yesterday, and then you lost the game in extra innings.
I did. Well, I didn't lose it, but I stopped short of winning it. That's the way I look at it. I didn't lose it. I learned my lesson. I should have won it. Right?
Potato, potato.
Yeah, just want to get the record straight. All right, coming up, Greg Flamm is going to be here at DuPage Picker. We'll also get an update on tonight's severe weather, which is moving fast through the area. The response, 815 says Wonder Lake is not 90 miles from Chicago. What is it then? 60 miles? 60, 75 miles?
I think Milwaukee is 90 miles.
All right, so 75. Around. Sorry. I take the back roads. I don't know what to tell you. Sorry. It's not by any way. Yeah. I love it. 630 is mad because I'm not talking more about the weather, which I should. We just talked 5 minutes about the weather. We have the right to take 2 minutes off from talking about the severe weather. But severe weather, as I get back up on the severe weather part, we are coming up on some serious storms that are moving through the area pretty fast. We'll get an update on that right after the break here with Doma T. Pongo. Stay with us.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Here we are.
Here we are. It's the Swap Meet sponsored by Wolf's Flea Market, 312-981-7200. This is a segment where Greg and I will evaluate your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk, 312-981-7200. Greg Flam, at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Good to see you. Thanks. You made it in from the rain.
Right. Yeah, I beat it in.
Yes. We just, the pictures you just saw of the rain delay at Guaranteed Rate was intense. The rain going sideways.
Yeah.
A very difficult night when it comes to severe weather here in Chicago. We'll keep you posted every 10 minutes or so here on 720 WGN. Greg, how you been?
Great. Until now.
Until now. Right. All right. All right. So let's talk about this. Let's talk about... first of all, how your week went. I mean, this is, we've been
prime
talking
time.
About all, this is prime time. This is the moment.
Yep.
Money. For pickers.
Money.
Money.
Yeah. It's a fun time because, as I mentioned, now there's garage sales like Tuesdays and Wednesdays. It's not just Friday and Saturday or Sunday. And it's always fun, you know, at Rosemont. I mean, you got 500 to 700 vendors. I mean, anything you want to find there. I've got a couple things here I brought that I found this week. But that's always fun, buying or selling. And, you know, I thought of something I wanted to bring up was the thing I get a kick out of is, you know, because I bring a lot of old media at my table
right.
I sell. I have 8-tracks. I have cassettes, reel-to-reel, everything. And it's just great to see, like, you know, the parents with their kids explaining old media. And I just kind of sit back and let them try to explain it. And then if they need help, I jump in, you know.
Right.
But that's just great that, you know, everything is kind of there for them to be like, this is how it was back in the day,
right.
You know, like what we listened to.
This, we've already explained the clear cassette. This is the white cassette, right?
right. Yeah.
All right, so you got some stuff. What do you got?
Okay, I found a, like, 1949 map of Germany, which is kind of cool because it shows
okay.
the boundaries during the war. It's pretty cool. It's pretty...
Wow. Was that just, like, where was that at?
Yeah, it was just at one of the tables, specializes in, was it ephemera? And, you know, just paper stuff. And I found it just in a stack of, you know, just papers and old maps and everything.
Are maps a big thing when it comes to pickers? Do people
they
like
are.
Maps?
Yeah, they are. And what seems to be in demand are the gasoline maps. They want the bigger logo of the Shell or the Phillips 66. They want the bigger logo on them because they repurpose them
right.
into like collages and stuff like that. So the bigger the logo of the gas company, the better.
Okay.
Anyway, and then I found this cool bubblegum disc of R.E.M.'s Monster, and it's they put out a few. They had like Stone Temple Pilots and other bands like that in the early 90s, but it's this one's cool.
Oh, it's actually bubblegum.
Yeah, and what's great about this is that it hasn't been, you know,
used,
chewed.
Yeah,
chewed. So, and what's and these go for about $40.
What is? I mean, is it actual music?
And
it's
it was
just
kind
a, it's
of
just a
spoof.
Piece of bubble gum inside of it.
Yeah,
right?
It was kind of a spoof. Like the REM one was called Monster, and this one they're calling it Gum Monster, and it's GUM like REM. So they did the spoof, kind of like
yeah.
Wacky Packs did on Groups. They did.
That sounds really
yeah, and it's
kind of
lame.
Dumb.
Wacky Packs did it better, but.
Yeah.
But anyway, so there's that. But and this one
yeah.
goes for about $40. So it's
is it hard
cool.
for you to resist chewing that up?
No, I had no problem passing that up. Being what 30 years
you're
old,
just sitting there like, I want that. I want that gum shaped like
yeah.
a CD.
I did find a signed Ron Rivera mini helmet, so that was kind of cool.
Oh wow! Okay.
For $1, yeah, and, you know. Yeah. And here's something I had repaired. Like these were the pull string puppets. They made them probably 10 different characters. It's the monkeys. This is Dr. Doolittle. They made Mrs. Beasley, all that. But anyway, we'll see if we can pick this up on the radio.
As a people doctor, I was a total failure.
And I found this. The string did not work. I sent it to this kid, 16-year-old kid in New York. He fixed it for me for $25. This thing's worth $100 now.
Hey, there you go.
So I put 35 into it. I'll get $100.
And, of course, you brought in, as you continued the series, of different series. Chicago Bears posters.
Yep, 1991 team roster. Harbaugh at the helm.
Oh, yeah. And who's that? That's a P.T. Willis years, huh?
Yep. And
let's take a look.
You got Ditka up here.
There's Ditka last year. Was he in 92 was his last year? Wonstead started in 93, right in that time?
Yeah, yeah.
So he's still got one more year. Yeah. So this is probably an 8-8 year.
You know, but you still got some good, great names. You got, you know, Rivera. You got your, oh, I was looking at it earlier.
I see
Singletary. Yep. We got Rivera.
I see an aging Dennis Gentry.
Yep. <That's good. laughs> You know, and Butler's still on the team on that one, so.
I see a fresh, wide-eyed Chris Gardocki,
mm-hmm.
the punter.
Yeah.
He's in a long career. I think he's still punting.
When did he start? When was his first year?
I don't know, Gardocki. But he looks like he's 15 years old. is that a future all-star Donnell Wolford, number 21 there?
Yeah, I think so.
And it's like maybe a rookie year for him early on. All right, there we go.
Yep.
I'm going to assume a Mark Carrier somewhere in the mix. Right.
Yeah, I was wondering if Duerson was still there, but that's not Duerson.
Oh, they changed it to a different 22. Yeah, you can see it's like you can really see the 85 Bears stick out as they get older. Like Mark Bortz, he's wide. He's still there, 62, but 62 stands out. You're like, this might be the last year for Mark Bortz. Anyway, great, 1991.
Yep. So, 91.
All right, 312-981-7200. Laura's already on the line. We got some texts coming in. What do you want to brag about? What do you want to find out? What's worth money? We're going to take a quick break, get an update on the weather. We will come back, and Laura, you'll be the first one in line here on the Swap Meet. Stay with us. We're tracking the severe weather in the area. We'll keep you updated. Doma Tipongo's all over it. We'll get an update in just a couple minutes here, but keep going with the Swap Meet. Greg Flamm in studio at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter.
Yep.
All right, let's get to it. We got some people calling in and texting. Let's go to Laura. Laura, what do you want to brag about tonight on the Swap Meet?
Hi, guys. I want to brag about I have three Gaudi pastel cards. One is Joe DiMaggio rookie card with his name misspelled. It has one G.
Wow.
Bill Dickey card. And I don't know if I'm going to say this guy's name right. Kiki Cuyler.
Kyler.
Okay. Mm.
Kiki Kyler. I just am assuming, just for the alliteration. Kiki Kyler. that's cool, right?
Yeah.
That's cool. I just like the idea that a rookie card would have a misspelled name from a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, I was able to find the 1938 rookie card, and it's gone as high as $3,000.
What?
I got to find the one she's mentioning, maybe.
I would think it'd be great. My question for you, Laura, have you used any of these cards as a toothpick?
No.
All right, good. I just started worrying about condition.
Good condition.
Okay, good.
And the Bill Dickey one, I'm seeing them like 150, so that's nothing compared to DiMaggio.
Yeah, but the DiMaggio one with the missing G, I think that's got to be like the upside down airplane, right? For stamps?
Stamps,
you know, the stamp with the upside down?
Yep.
Brewster's Millions, anyone?
Yeah, and, I got to try to find that one, but it's not coming up.
Well, I like that. Laura, I would say that's a big deal, and I have to say, just from my experience with Greg on this program, that there is a whole industry of sports memorabilia places that will grade that and tell you how much that's worth.
Okay, well, that's what I was going to ask, too. Some people have said you can get them insured and grade it.
Yeah.
But you have to be careful about the grading because it'll cost you money to grade it, and you might not get what the card is worth. I also have, like, seven exhibit cards, and I got some batter-up die cuts.
Okay. They charge about $15 to $20 to grade it, and they'll seal it for you. So, and obviously the higher the grade, the higher the money.
Yeah. Right.
All right. Thanks, Laura.
Okay,
appreciate it.
Thanks
for the call.
Thanks for calling.
All right. So 815 says, I love this. I have an Eddie Curry signed high school banner. Eddie Curry, of course, played here. Where'd he play at? Thornwood? Where'd he play? Anyway, he played somewhere in the area. Mm-hmm. And I should know this because he was a Chicago Bull for one time, a number one draft pick who was, of course, in the NBA lottery. He played for the Bulls until I think he had a heart murmur of some sort that kind of like threw him out. But yeah, it was Thornwood and but an Eddie Curry signed high school banner. What is that? What does that even mean? You mean like a sort of banner that goes "Go Thornton Wildcats" or whatever it is?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking it is.
Is that worth anything when you get that kind of sign on a sign like that?
I would think it is, but I'm not going to put it more than 200 to 300 at the most.
Okay.
But, yeah, his card's not going for much.
Oh, poor Eddie.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
Not showing the love there.
You know, Eddie Curry, I will say, look it up. The story, Eddie Curry's had a tough go of it.
Yeah, was it after the motorcycle?
No, that's Jay Williams. It's an entirely different tough go of
tough
it.
Tough go in the Bulls.
But Eddie Curry, I read this whole story about how he got into trouble with gambling. Like, it was like a – it was – like a strange kind of thing where they play cards on the plane. You know, when the guys like will play back and forth and they play cards and they go $1,000 on this hand or whatever. He had got into it with a couple of players who were like, I think we're trying to sue him for winning. I don't know how you do that off of a plane card game, but what do I know?
Yeah.
All right, let's keep going here.
Funny.
Let's see. Question for the swap meet. I have two different animated sets of scenes from the Rankin-Bass Christmas specials. Yes. One from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and one from Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Little Burl Ives. Isn't that Burl Ives?
Yep.
Joint? At least I think those are the two. You push a button and the figures move. Each is about 12 by 12 by 6. Still in the box. Any thoughts, Carol?
Yeah, there looks like they're going between 125 and 400. Obviously, in the box, you'd probably be at that 400 range. I could not find the you said they said they had Rudolph and Santa. I found the Rudolph. It was like 125 out of the box.
125 out of the box.
I could not find the Santa
one. Ah, that's too bad. You know, I have to look at this and say, okay, you push a button and the figurines move. I might have this at home because when we do Christmas and the wife puts out the Christmas stuff, there's always that Rankin and Bass. I think it might be the same. I don't think it moves, though. They're just like ceramic kind of things.
Yeah, they kind of have a round base. The base is kind of like that thick. So.
But you put it like on the coffee table, and you're like, oh, this is really nice. Don't play with it. It's really
right,
nice.
Don't play with it.
Right. And then the same, we have the VHS of all the Rankin Bass Christmas specials.
Yep.
Is that worth anything? They're not in good shape.
Yeah, probably not.
I want to make it very clear. If I were calling into the swap meet, that would be how I'd start. I want to make it very clear right now. These are not in good shape.
Right. Poor condition.
None of what I have is in good shape.
Right.
I told you, like, and I want to do this. I still want to do this because when we went out to Crystal Lake and you came out to Crystal Lake, the Dukes, to play that night, I was trying to get my dad to bring all the stuff that I had, like a mystery thing.
I was looking
forward to it. He was like, it's cold and I can't get down to the pole barn to get it.
Yep.
So now it's summertime. I'm going back up there in about a week or two. So I'm going to go up there. I'm going to get a whole thing. We're going to have a mystery box. Justin's teenage mystery box.
I also have some news for you. The jersey that Alyssa Milano was wearing is the California Golden Bears.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. So
it's not the New Jersey Devils?
No.
I thought it was the New Jersey
Devils. Yeah, I heard you talk about the other night. I figured I'd look it up and double check that for you.
I don't have that poster anymore.
Yeah.
That's too bad. Josh, what do you got? What do you want to brag about?
Yeah, I actually have this old Victor Victrola. It's like a record player / radio, those old school units from like the late 60s, early 70s, the big wooden ones weigh like 200 pounds.
Right.
Got one of those, and I know records are really coming back, so I was just wondering how much those would go for. It's in pretty good condition.
An old Victrola, you know, and I would say that it always feels like the Victrola is just would be a cool decorative piece. In a cool living room that someone
it
paid
is.
Way
it's
too much
cool.
money
I got a
for,
big
right?
Collection.
Yeah,
yeah.
But it doesn't matter if it works or not.
Some of them, some of them are in the $1,000-$1,600 range.
Oh wow, I got it for free
for the player. So that's great. Obviously, condition, can affect that. So, what kind of condition Is yours?
Oh, it's in great condition. Whoever had it before, you know, took care of it. They didn't want it. They didn't want to move it. They, you know, the wood is in great condition. I polished it up when I got home, cleaned it all up, got all the crevices, and it works great. And I got a huge collection to go with it, so I use it all the time.
So what you're saying, Josh, is that the person you got it from didn't like the party. The old Victrola, they're like, we don't actually play it.
Right.
That would be a mistake, right? And so that worked for your advantage.
And to be clear, it's not the tabletop one, right? It's the full console, like furniture?
It's the full console.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, the thing's huge. And, you know, you open up the cabinet on top, and you got the record player on one side and the radio on the other side. And, you know, got the Pink Floyd to go with it. Nice. So it's...
Like I said, you're between 600 and 1600, 2000 maybe in great condition.
All right. Wow. Thanks, Josh.
Thanks.
All right. There you go. 312-981-7200. Denise, you're on the line. You're up next. You got some texters as well. Keep them coming. 312-981-7200. We'll get an update on the news and weather with Doma Tipongo, and then we'll get back to the swap meet here on 720 WGN. Stay with us.
It's time for swap meet. Oh, yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Or it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
That's me.
All right. It's a Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. We are evaluating your memorabilia, your collectibles, your junk. What do you want to brag about? Tonight's the night. We've got people on the line ready to do just that. Let's get to it. Again, 312-981-7200. All right, let's go to Paul. Paul, what do you want to brag about, Paul?
Well, my wife got me a Mego Spider-Man from the 70s. Still in the package, on the cardboard, really good shape. Although all the text is in Spanish.
Wow. Whoa. Cool.
Yeah, so instead of saying The Amazing Spider-Man, it's like El Hombre de Spider.
Nice.
I was really happy to get it, but I was very surprised that it was in Spanish, and she didn't even notice.
Wow. That's awesome.
I mean, the English version is 500 to 1,000, so...
Holy.
So yeah. What's the pesos?
Right.
We'll see
what the Spanish version is. But, I'm not finding that version of it. So, you know, I'm going to guess more like 600-700, but I could be wrong. I just can't find that one right now.
Right. Well, I've never had the heart to open it. It's just been in a...
Oh, please don't.
...on display.
Yeah, don't ever open that thing. So that's cool, though.
There you go. That's good. That's good money. All right, Paul, see you on your way.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you, buddy.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for calling. Let's go to Denise. Denise, what do you want to brag about, Denise? Hi.
Well, I have from 77, the original. I've got Vader, Leia, Han, C-3PO, R2-D2.
Is this Buck Rogers? What are we talking about?
No, I'm sorry. Star Wars characters. And still in there, you know, the original. We never opened them because we would laugh at my husband when he would get one and the kids would play, and then he would be like, these are going to be worth some. This is a great movie. And we'd be like, right.
Yep.
That is good foresight.
And actually, he had a Boba Fett, which was not even in the original movie.
Oh, wow.
And he had gone through boxes and boxes, and one of the kids opened it.
Wow. I hate it. Yeah.
So are these worth anything, really?
Yeah, they sure are. Okay. Some of them, I didn't catch which one was 4,500.
4,500?
But the Vader, I don't think, is the 4,500 one, but I'm trying to
recall. Leah Hands?
Yeah, I'm trying to pull up those.
Chewbacca?
They're so rare that I'm really not even finding them. A lot of people just, like, well, they'll be open. They'll still have the cardboard backing and the cover, but they're opened. And, you know, some of those are getting, like, $150 to $200.
Yours aren't open.
Is still sealed, so you're up there. I'm going to guess, you know, your Vader's probably $450 to $650.
What?
Okay.
You know, and like I said, some of those, Kenner is what you want to look for. If you're ever buying these, you want to make sure they're the Kenner ones from like the 70s, late 70s. And they can be, you know, up there in the 4,000 range.
Now, what about like the other movies? Because we have, you know, those.
Like Harry Potter?
No,
oh,
no,
you
no.
mean the other Star Wars?
Star Wars. Another Star Wars.
Star Wars. Gotcha, sorry.
Right. It's the yeah. All Star Wars.
I'm just joking segment. Around.
I know.
Let's see.
Like Empire Strikes Back.
Any more valuable than you know than others?
I,
like
Denise, I have the. I don't want to brag, but I have yeah. The Luke Skywalker in winter garb.
Nice.
Out of the package.
Okay.
Chewed
okay.
up by my dog. So
again, poor condition again.
Again, very
about,
poor condition.
What about the original comic books also?
Oh wow.
And cards.
Look
yeah,
at that.
That I've had to look up. Was okay. going to say again, the other movies like, you know, Empire mm-hmm. Strikes Back, the same thing. You want Kenner is the brand you want.
Right,
the
Kenner
later ones,
they
changed
Kenner.
The brand and they're
right,
not
now they're
much.
All Kenner. Exactly.
Yeah. No, you got some
about,
good stuff then.
Okay, and comic book, and then what about the cards and then the packages that the cards came in?
You got all the stuff.
Okay.
I know.
Have just
do you have, a, gonna, do you have okay. an X-Wing fighter?
X-Wing fighter?
Yeah, like the ship.
Oh, no, oh, you know, we did.
Well,
but, okay, I have another real quick question. I don't even know if you know these. Chewbox? Do you know what I'm talking about? They were Chewbops. They were bubblegum records.
Yeah.
Oh,
and that's
yeah,
what we
yeah.
got right here. We got that's what that okay. that's what Greg brought in tonight.
Well, I have the CD, okay. but I think they did the same thing with records. But they weren't the same size as records. They were smaller, like mini.
They were, right.
Yeah, yeah they were like 3x3. I'm sure they are. If the okay. CDs are getting $40, those have to be in the yeah. 50, especially if they're still sealed. But I do remember
yeah,
those now.
Sealed.
Yeah,
and actually,
do you know which ones
like
you had?
We have like the Beatles,
oh, wow.
Elvis. You know, those kind of things.
Wow, yeah. All right. No, if they're sealed, you definitely, I would think.
So how do
be...
I get rid of this stuff if I want to?
Well, yeah. if your family member's on eBay or something, you could try that. Yeah. You're going to get uh-huh. your most money on eBay if you do Craigslist.
What are these kids doing?
Offer up.
These kids that are that
yeah,
that were ripping up the Boba Fett package. It's on them. They gotta figure it out.
All right.
So seriously, you think maybe eBay is the best?
Yeah the best that, you're okay. going to get the most money there.
All right. Thanks, Denise.
Okay. Hey, thank you
thank
so much.
Thank you. Good luck.
I've got a Endor Planet Speeder. Remember the speeders
yeah.
that the square stormtroopers? Mm-hmm. Broken, out of the box,
poor condition.
Chewed up, poor condition.
Right.
Where are we at?
That's awesome.
All right, let's go to Sharon. Sharon, what do you want to brag about, Sharon?
Yeah, I've got a Supergirl comic book. It's a DC from 1985.
Yeah, classic year.
She's in a plastic bag.
Okay.
What is she worth?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like comic books are hard. I think, I don't know. He's going to tell you in a second. He's looking it up. But I would think, you know, every time I go into a comic book shop, I go in with my son, I feel like they got a million gazillion comics from like the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Because the color on the case on the outside is still brilliant.
Yeah, you're about $10 to $20, and as Justin's saying, I'm always disappointed myself, too, with comic books. I think I have something that's in great condition. Then I look it up, and it's like $4. I'm like, oh,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah, it feels like they just made a lot of those.
You know, it's just, it's kind of that needle in haystack, kind of with the Beanie Babies. There's those five that are worth, you know, a lot of money.
Thanks, Sharon. Okay, 312-981-7200. I got Doris on the line. I want to get to you on the Ryan Sandberg baseball card. I want to get to Joe. He's got a tennis racket we're going to talk about. Online, we got the VH copy of the original trilogy of Star Wars. I've got a Charlie Weaver bartending machine, battery-operated, smoke out of the ears. So much to talk about, but we're going to take a break real quick and come back and finish up the swap meet tonight. 312-981-7200. It's a swap meet here, 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. Justin Kaufman, Greg Flamm, at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter with us as well. All right, let's go to some of the line. Let's go to Joe. Joe, what do you want to brag about, Joe?
Hey, listen, a pleasure talking to the vintage gurus one more time.
That's right.
I got an old tennis racket, got to be 40, 45 plus. And let me ask a question first before I describe it. Did they used to make the webbing out of catgut, or is that my imagination?
I had heard that before, yeah. I had heard that they did. Mm-hmm. I don't know like what year they stopped doing that, but you're right, I have heard that before.
So if I found an old one and I kind of just kind of thumb through it when I'm playing with my kitty, I can. It's almost like a scare tactic.
You scare the heck out of the cat. Right. Yeah. This is a Billy Martin, Rawlings Pro Grade, if you will. And I only, I recall using it, and it seems to be probably about 85% good condition.
Okay.
Leather grip and all that good stuff.
All right. 40-plus years old. What do you think, Greg? I mean, old tennis rackets. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's, I feel if there, if this comes back and you say, oh, wow, it's a lot of money, I'm a rich man because I'm going to go into the old shed and find all the old rackets from when we grew up, right?
Same thing I thought about. Yeah. Forgot about the doggone thing. It's in the garage, you know. You know.
Yeah,
yeah. It looks like most of them are between $20 and $40. Yeah. I can't find the Billy Martin, you know, your exact model, but like Jimmy Connors and some of those Chris Everett wooden ones, $20 to $40.
Well, I'll be darned. Okay, right. Well, that doesn't surprise me. I didn't think it was worth too much.
Yeah, cool. Thanks for calling in, Joe. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Nice.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Doris. Doris.
Hey.
What do you want to brag about?
I have three baseball cards. I have an All-Star of Ryan Sundberg and Frank Viola.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have Scott Sanderson with his record from 78 to 1990.
What are they, signed, or are they just cards?
They're just cards, baseball cards. I've been having them like 30 years or more.
Why do you just have three?
I don't know.
Like,
that's,
does it feel like,
I
mean, I'm not judging, I'm just saying, like, I feel like there'd be like a bag of them. Or
no.
There'd be one that's like sealed and signed, but the idea of just having three randos from 1990 or like the 80s.
Remember how you used to buy the bubble gum and they had the baseball cards in there? I think that's where these.
No, it was the other way around. You bought the baseball and you got the bubble gum in there. So you were telling me, right, Doris, that you're like, I really like that gum. I'm going for the gum. I don't care about the cards.
Yeah, I mean, I like it.
Yeah.
What do you think? I mean, random baseball cards like that?
I mean, the Sandberg All-Star card can go from $2 to $200.
So, I mean, I guess you're getting an investment on the gum.
Yeah, and it depends on the condition again, and baseball cards are kind of like that with
Yeah.
Yeah, they're in good condition.
They are, okay.
Uh-huh.
The other two are going to be less, I'll bet. I mean, Frankie Viola, great left-handed curveball pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if it's, I mean, he's even in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and I wouldn't think it's higher than Sandberg.
Although I'm intrigued by the Scott Sanderson card, but we'll that's just me. All right, thanks, Doris. We got to move. Thank you.
Thank you.
I like that. I should have asked, was Sanderson an Expo at the time or a Cub, right? Wasn't he an Expo for a while?
Yeah, I found some Cubs with him, yeah.
Yeah, but same thing,
$2, $3. $1, yeah, $2.
Dave, what do you want to brag about, Dave?
Well, I want to know what the possible value of something that's long lost due to my own malfeasance. I had an odd-sized Hank Aaron mid-70s Atlanta Braves card. It was maybe 4x6.
Okay. Odd size.
Yeah, or maybe 3x5, but it was bigger, you know, than a regular baseball card. And I destroyed it as an implement for hash under glass. So it's long story. But I was always wondered what it might have been worth if I kept it all these years, because it wasn't pristine, and it would have remained pristine.
Yeah, I'm seeing them from $14 to $1,000, depending, you know, on the grade and if they were graded. But at least you used it as a window.
Had $1,000.
At least you used it with your window and not a bicycle.
Yeah, right. 14th, I don't feel so bad.
Yeah, right. There
right.
You go. There
yeah,
you go.
Don't feel too bad.
Don't feel too bad. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to some of these texts as we wrap up here. Ren and Stimpy, number one issue, scratch and sniff cover and sealed bag. 773's got that.
Yeah.
Ren and Stimpy, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
I don't get too many Ren and Stimpy memorabilia.
Right. I mean, I was finding $5 to $18, but I didn't get the scratch and sniff part, so that might make a difference.
Yeah. All right, 630 says they got a VHS copy of the original trilogy of Star Wars before any CGI was added in by Lucas.
Yeah, it looks like they go upwards of close to $100.
Oh, really?
Sealed or, you know.
I've got the same trilogy before CGI.
Poor
terrible condition.
Right.
One of the tapes is broken.
Yep.
Has been used. A lot of candle wax on it. It was a piece by the TV. Anyway. Yep. 312 wants to know, I have a Charlie Weaver bartending machine, battery operated, smoke out of the ears. What?
Yeah, in perfect or mint condition, that can go upwards of $200.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hmm. Mm.
Yeah, that would be your novelty barware, which I do collect that stuff.
Oh, okay. 608, I have a Woody Woodpecker toy that talks when the string is pulled. It needs repair on the talking mechanism. Can you get me in touch with the young man in New York?
Yeah, he can write at the Facebook page, DuPage Picker there.
Well, what's a Woody Woodpecker with the, when the talking mechanism is fixed?
Yeah, sometimes like the string will be stuck, whether it's all the way extended or still in close proximity of the puppet, and it's just locked up. It just won't move. But this guy did great work. He turned it around in less than 10 days, and it was only $25. So, I can't recommend him enough.
All right, let's finish it up with Mary. Mary, what do you want to brag about, Mary?
I have the very last issue of George Magazine, the original package that was mailed to me in.
Yeah, that was this week. Earlier this week was the anniversary of that, of the plane crash, which is...
Oh, was it really?
Yeah, like Monday, I think it was. Let me look that up for you.
I was just watching... It's funny, I was just watching Defiant Ones, and I thought I saw John Jr. in one of the football games over at Jimmy Iovine's house.
Yeah, looks like they're starting around $20. I'm trying to get you some better info.
Well, there you go, Mary. A little $20 might work. Last issue of George Magazine. Thanks for the call. Yep. All right, that's going to do it tonight. Greg Flamm, always a pleasure.
Yep, always fun.
It was always fun, and we will be back next Wednesday, 312-981-7200. Greg, great to see you.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it tonight for the download. We're back tomorrow, of course. Sandra Bernhardt, guest at the big table. Stand-up comedian, performance artist. Talk with her, actress. She'll be here. And much, much more. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. Well, it seems like the severe storms have moved through the area, but we'll make sure of that.